Welcome. The peace revolution now continues.
Breaker, breaker, 1-9. I'm in outer space with a microphone.
There is a peaceful solution called peace revolution. Now let's take back America. There's a war and we're in it. I know we can win it, so let's take back America. There was a dream, so believe it, and get ready to receive it. Now let's take back America. And when the war is over and we've won it, let's remember how we done it, so we don't have to do it again. There is a peaceful solution called the peace revolution. Now let's take back America.
Welcome to the Peace Revolution Podcast. I'm your host and navigator, Richard Grove, and this is where we step out of the confusion, fear, and anxiety of everyday life to relax into some knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. You're listening to Podomatic's number one rated podcast in higher education. Thank you for making time in your busy schedule to tune in and grow in the light direction. Peace Revolution and all the educational media we create here at TragedyandHope.com is presented as a public service without corporate sponsorship and is published commercial-free and presented free to the public. Thanks to the generosity of the subscribers of the Tragedy and Hope online community and the hard work of the media hosts featured at TragedyandHope.com. I encourage you to check out the episode notes, references, and links for this and all episodes we publish at peacerevolution.org. I also invite you to click the invitation link in the episode notes and participate in the Tragedy and Hope online community and learn how to apply this very interesting journey of discovery to your everyday life. If after studying the episode notes you're looking to know more, Peace Revolution also has several partner podcasts which likewise feature commercial-free educational episodes, also free to the public, including CorbettReport.com, GnosticMedia.com, MediaMonarchy.com, RemedyRadio.com, and the Unplugged Mom Podcast, as well as many others, each of which uniquely fills the void left by public schooling and mainstream media. This is the fifth installment of a very special interview episode series of Peace Revolution, featuring the gentle tone, scholarly insights, and wealth of wisdom that combines in the form of John Taylor Gatto, the legendary educator, author, and icon of liberty, who herein offers a lifetime of perspectives on the origins, intentions, and destiny of the compulsory public school system and its role in our everyday lives. The audio for this episode is taken from the fifth hour of the Ultimate History Lesson, A Weekend with John Taylor Gatto, and I'm joined once again by Paul Verge, Jan Irvin, Kevin Cole, Tony Myers, and Lisa Arborcheski. And together, we'll be providing you with the historical analysis, contextual connections, references, and the other historical artifacts, which will help you gain a better grasp on the momentous discoveries embedded herein. I've also included the closing, which summarizes the disc set, so after the fourth part of the roundtable in today's discussion, what you're hearing is the same summary as those who purchased the entire disc set, those who made this all possible in the first place. Your place in history is now secure. This is episode 45, The Ultimate History Lesson with John Taylor Gatto, Hour 5 plus commentary. Thank you for your support, and thank you for tuning in and not dropping out.
The 7D, I have to do manually anyway.
It okay. It all right, cool.
We've all heard about the hard way to learn, John. Is there an easy way to learn?
If you begin and understand yourself thoroughly, and you have a lot of raw experience, I think natural powers are released. And I do believe that all the graceful, easy learning comes from people who are comfortable inside their own skin because they understand. And people who've had a lot of early experience. And I operated on those principles, even though it was illegal in a public school setting. I set aside one full day a week. I won't get into the politics of how this was pulled off, but it was never easy, where the kids could follow their own instincts anywhere in New York City they wanted to go. One full day a week where I took them on group projects, different parts of the five boroughs in New York City, that would group projects that would end up with a tangible goal, such as testing. I remember this one might amuse the people watching this. The New York Times announced on the front page about 3 weeks before the Ed Koch, Dave Dinkins election of, let me say 1980, somewhere around there, that Dinkins was hopelessly behind by 17 points. And I had a black kid in the class come up and ask me why the city was so prejudiced. And I said, why do you say that? And he said, well, look at this. And I said, well, why do you believe that's true? Maybe that's to get you not to go and vote. I don't know, I said, but I do know that it says here in small print that they only interviewed 300 people. There's 8 million of us. I said, there's 120 people in my five classes. If each one of you do 20 interviews, and we do it according to the way you get a random distribution, and that's easy enough to find out, well, we can have many times larger sample than. So that happened. We gathered the data. We processed it. And we discovered, about a week after the Times said he hopefully was behind, that he actually was ahead by a fraction of 1 point. That's quite askew. The election came. He won in the closest race in New York history. But notice that a random group of 120 13-year-olds had produced more accurate information. The math in the statistical processing is hardly daunting for a fifth grader. You know, so why aren't the 70 million captive school children involved in, if nothing else, data gathering, since obviously it's a crucial part of commerce? You know, opinion. Well, there must be a reason they're not used that way, nor do they hear about statistical sampling until they're in college, for the most part. Why not? According to Alfred North Whitehead, one of the major mathematicians of the 20th century, other than addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division, the only crucial piece of math for everyone to learn is statistical sampling predictions, because the society, the economy is organized around those things. The politics is organized around those things. He said that in Aims of Education, which I think was published in the mid-1940s. Well, you know, 60 years have gone by, and where is it? He's hardly a radical.
Is it possible to train fleas before you break their will? And what can one learn from the gene sequencing hobbies of 11-year-olds?
I got a foundation award at a fancy hotel in Washington, D.C. Oh, I guess about 15 years ago. It was certainly a while ago. And sitting next to me was an 11-year-old boy receiving the same award from the foundation. And, I mean, I was tickled. Here's this little skinny Chinese kid. And he has... and made some scientific breakthroughs. So, you know, I'm patronizing him the way I've been trained to do. And I said, well, how did you learn to sequence genes? You know, instead of swimming. I'm a swimming champion. I remember he said that to me. I have a lot of medals. So he was a well-balanced 11-year-old kid. And these days I understand he's a college professor in Seattle. But in any case, he said, my uncle or my grandfather explained to me that the way you train fleas, he hit a soft part in me because I used to go to Hubert's Flea Circus on 42nd Street and watch fleas draw Roman chariots and swing on trapezes. He said, you've got to break their spirits. If you put fleas in a container, they'll instantly leap off and head off in all directions because they have flea agendas, and even they don't all in the same direction. They have individual agendas. So he says, you gotta break that autonomy in the flea first. And the way you do that is you put them in a container, small, with a lid on, and the fleas keep attempting to follow their own agenda. And they strike themselves over and over again. And if you come back in an hour or so, they're all huddled in a mass together. Now when you take the lid off, they don't even try to escape. Now, he said, you can impose your will on the flea. The minute the 11-year-old kid said that to me, I knew that I had been hired as the lid on the container. Not that I hadn't sabotaged it somewhat, but nevertheless, that's what we all had been hired to do. And this principle was understood. Training fleas was a delight of emperors thousands of years ago. And whoever trained those fleas understood the principle and saw that it could be applied, as it is in military training, to human beings, as it is in much religious training. Not all, but much.
So you've got a character like Wundt, who believes that children have no soul, and he's designing an education system, and then you've got these Machiavellian techniques being layered in on top of it of how to break the will of animals, and it's being used to train our children.
Yeah, what's surprising is that these insights and even these activities that don't depend on modern technology. I mean, these are understood a long time ago. And the only subject at the Roman Collegia in the 5th century was, I'll put an umbrella over it, crowd control. You know, how you divide to conquer, what buttons on the human organ you press to produce certain sounds. I mean, that's 16 centuries ago. What has happened in the intervening 16 centuries? They forgot that, or was it added to? Has it become amazingly sophisticated? Less and less people necessary to produce more and more leverage.
Is there a connection between the ideals of someone like Calvin and his espousing a theocratic state and modern states like Israel, which are also built along the same theocratic terms?
I think, and I'm trying to be as fair as possible to the villains in this, I think there's some impulsion in everyone to have certainty that even as babies we're aware of how many accidents, how much menace is out there, jeopardy, certainty. So to follow a list of rules, algorithms, you know, is emotionally very satisfying, but it doesn't work if everyone's not doing it. You know, and the minute everyone's doing it, you don't have to do it. You now are handed freedom because the menace has been reduced of other people experimenting with humanity, enlarging its boundaries. And then economically, of course, your capital's at risk. If that's the overproduction thing, I hope we talked about that yesterday. Because it finally was the tipping point in the late 19th century as corporations were enlarging and layering themselves. Men like Carnegie and Rockefeller and Astor, they were fully aware that human ingenuity was a tremendous risk to capital formation, because to talk people out of their wealth on the grounds that you can multiply it doesn't work if too many people invent ways to do something better than your investment. You know, the capital's destroyed. So the easiest way to manage the future and the present, of course, they saw a series of financial crises all through history, but especially in the 19th century, where the boot of the master had been lifted off ordinary people, and they were recklessly inventive. I mean, America's producing more inventions than all the rest of the world put together. You can't have that, because on that new base, the next base is going to be frightening. So a term existed and exists, but it's been camouflaged in the 21st century, called overproduction. You have to use government to control overproduction, dumping too many goods or services on the market that it can't absorb. And the easiest way to do that, at first you try licensing, you know, and other kinds of government subsidy to favored groups. But ultimately, the killer app is to remove the ability to be inventive from the ordinary mass. These days it's called overcapacity, because to penetrate what that means is much harder than to see instantly what overproduction means. Then a second menace emerged in the late 19th century, but by the late 1960s, it was clear it too would have to be controlled. That's called hyper-democracy. If too many people take democracy seriously and understand how to form alliances with one another to confront power with power, then power becomes much less effective. So when the kids stopped the Vietnamese War, waves of them, I mean, this was so intolerable. The cost to privileged classes of this reign of money, the cost to the government of not being able to suppress dissent on the grounds that this is an emergency, this couldn't be allowed to happen again.
Welcome back to Peace Revolution. This is episode 45, the fifth hour of the Ultimate History Lesson, A Weekend with John Taylor Gatto. And just when you think you're almost out of this, he drags you back in. This 15 minutes, again, is dense with primary sources that I had to go out and make myself familiar, or more familiar with in some cases. He starts out by talking about the raw experience and the power of raw experience and the natural powers within each individual, that being of curiosity and the open eyes of not knowing and looking for answers. that's taken out by the school system. So what he's mentioning is that the people who have this raw experience, these natural powers of curiosity that haven't been stomped out by a school system, they become comfortable. They become comfortable because they're understanding, and they therefore have time to think beyond their survival. And that's what he's describing, is these other modes of thought that come after you've figured out how you're going to be safe and have food and have water and these sort of things, right? Then he moves into the training of fleas. Now, I ask him that question because I had reviewed not only his books, but his lectures and his videos, and I had like a 50-page outline, which we didn't use for the interview, but one of the questions I had to ask him was, you know, how does one come to be familiar with this, and how are fleas trained in this sort of idea, to get him to talk about this story? So the misnomer is that fleas aren't actually trained. They're just identified for their unique aspect, just like the school system does. They're then harnessed according to these unique properties that they possess. Whether they are the type of flea that runs, then we'll strap a chariot onto him and it'll look like he's pushing a chariot. Or if he's the type that jumps, then we're going to do this other thing to him. And it makes it look like they've been trained to do these tricks, but really it's just an identification of their natural affinities and their natural characteristics, and then harnessing them and putting them to action. So not only is that like our school system today, but, you know, in going into how they break autonomy, et cetera, with the school system, but what he's saying is that emperors thousands of years ago had figured this out, and to them it was very entertaining because it was a microcosm that they could directly apply to crowd control. So John asked the question, has this not evolved? Has this not been incorporated into military training, et cetera, et cetera? And then Tony mentioned he was reading from von Clausewitz the other day, and there's a tie-in. So do you want to go with that?
Sure, I'll go ahead with that. So the other day, well, to give some context, it's from the book On War by Karl von Clausewitz, and Clausewitz was at the Battle of Jena and saw what happened to the professional army of Prussia compared to the amateur army of Napoleon, and how badly they were defeated because of the fact that individuals were so well taught in the liberal arts, and even though they were professionals and all this military training, strategic training, how to kill, it didn't matter because they refused to take orders when times were tough because they had critical thinking and refused orders from people.
They weren't dependent enough on the system.
Right, exactly. And had that provisional self-esteem. So essentially what happened was they crumbled, and he did kind of a write-up, as to the institutional write-up, as to what happened at this battle. And there's an interesting passage on page 490, and it states, "But if it might be said, whoever has possession of the district of Langres commands all France as far as Paris. That is to say, it only rests with himself to take possession. That is plainly a very different thing, something of much higher importance. According to the first kind of conception, the possession of the country cannot be thought of without the possession of the point which we have called key. That is a thing which is intelligible to the most ordinary capacity. But according to the second kind of conception, the possession of the point which we have called a key cannot be imagined without the possession of the country following as a necessary consequence. That is plainly something marvelous. Common sense is no longer sufficient to grasp this. The magic of the occult sciences must be called into requisition. This Kabbalah came into existence in works published 50 years ago and reached its zenith at the end of the last century. And notwithstanding the irresistible force, certainty, and distinctness with which Bonaparte's method of conducting war carried conviction, generally this Kabbalah has, nevertheless, still managed, we say, to spin out the thread of its tenacious existence through the medium of books."
So what we're observing is that the black arts, the arts of deception, are being practiced to train and condition us as children, our parents as children, and future generations, unless we come together and start understanding our history and refuse to let it repeat. Because what John is saying is, hey, kids, this has been going on for thousands of years. And it doesn't mean it has to go on into the future, but you actually have to recognize how it went on, why it continues to propagate, and figure out some new and unthought of system to get in the middle and break up in order to, you know, disconcert that wave of dissonance. So John's saying that this is understood a long time ago. He mentions the Roman Collegia was specifically a group of merchants and sometimes criminals and pirates who practiced the art of crowd control. this is the origin of our political rhetoric, the political antics that we see today, this whole notion that somebody we don't know, that we've never met, that we've never talked to, can somehow represent our best interests. And that's part of the key of what we're talking here about, the illusions used to play people like instruments. And whether it's Machiavelli and his books like The Art of War or The Discourses or The Prince, what we're seeing is a small group of people who is highly organized, highly educated, and has read specifically the books which allow them to very easily manipulate other people who haven't read these same books. And what they're doing is they're carrying out experiments on the masses, those who are unorganized, the 99%, if you will. And they're also controlling things through the government interference into the economy, the non-laissez-faire type of capitalism that is practiced here in America, where the government comes in and these corporations come in to manage, artificially manage, the overproduction of these production lines. So you've got groups like Carnegie and Rockefeller and all these other big, powerful magnates who were there on the scene to heavily influence America through the beginning of the 20th century and all the way through today. So these are tectonic historic events that have such relevance that it's practically a crime that we were not taught this during the 15,000 hours of public schooling.
If I can throw in some thoughts there, I thought it was interesting that John touched on the idea of experience, because I think experience itself is the best teacher. And of course, being sat in a desk all day, it gets removed in school. You get the experience of being in jail, which drives a lot of people crazy. And so we're taught to defer our experience into belief in whatever we're being taught at the time to memorize. And, you know, you got to ask the question, when in school did you ever get the opportunity to fact check your textbooks, right? It's completely assumed from the beginning that whatever's in the textbooks are true. And so you're taught to defer that notion of critical thinking because you're essentially conditioned to think if it's in a book, it's probably true. But, and that's why we've separated books into fiction and nonfiction. So all nonfiction books are apparently true, but they're not called true books. They're called nonfiction. And then the idea of training fleas, I think that just goes to show whether you're a pigeon, a flea, or a human being, or a dog, if a brain is a computer, then anything with a brain can be programmed and short-circuited and conditioned. It can have parameters set for it and have its perceptions of reality modified. And so this idea of the lids on containers is what keeps us compartmentalized. And that word is two words, compartment and mentalized. It's disconnecting reality into all these artificially separated nodes where the connections between these nodes are occulted, right? So everything is right in front of us, these circles. If you want to picture like a Kabbalah tree of life, it's a bunch of circles in a shape, but it's the connections that give the shape to those circles and generate every possible, you know, geometric pattern that's observable in reality in sacred geometry. So with those connections occulted, it just looks like a bunch of dots. And we have to learn critically to connect these dots. When you do a connect the dots puzzle, you could connect every dot to every single other one, but you know enough innately to go on the outside and build a shape, right? Something that's familiar. So I think it just comes down to this idea that the elites have had for probably thousands of years, that if they control the perceptions of reality, which they've gotten better and better at doing, then you can program entire populations and you don't need physical force to control populations.
I wanted to jump in real quick and say that Daniel Feldman's book on the Kabbalah discusses how the mind works as a computer and as a 3D model through what is revealed in the Kabbalah. And what he does is, in that book, he shows that there is a way that certain people like sorcerers and wizards can use the Kabbalah to keep people down. And he shows in a sense how that is possible to be done through that. But I just wanted to bring up his book because I think it's important for people to understand how the Trivium and Quadrivium plug into the Kabbalah, and where the knowledge first position in the Kabbalah is actually the knowledge first position in the Trivium as well. And the Kabbalah contains knowledge, understanding, and wisdom, as the trivium is knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. So that plugs directly into the Kabbalah, and then how that the next aspect of the geometry works with the Kabbalah is with the quadrivium, and the Kabbalah is made up of 5, 3, 4 triangles, and of course, geometry and whatnot, the triangles are geometry of the quadrivium and the 5, 3, 4, so it all fits right together.
Well, you know, Jan, it's interesting you mentioned that, because before we started recording, you had mentioned that you were reading the book, what was it called again, by Feldman?
Feldman's book is just called Kabbalah.
Just called Kabbalah, with a Q.
Right.
And how within the Tree of Life and the Kabbalah is contained the trivium and quadrivium. Now, the interesting thing here is that what happens, especially with Gada mentioning that it's so important for children to have raw experience, and by going out and experiencing life as it is, they have this natural curiosity. It's almost like having these natural powers. And so it's interesting that you mentioned that with what they do is they disconnect our knowledge, and we're fallen from the tree, right? They disconnect the grammar. Now, children, within this, having this natural curiosity, that is that general grammar. They go out and just observe and take in all these raw pieces of data by nature. But once they cut off that creative function, which Gatto then mentions later with the whole crisis of democracy with Carnegie, Rockefeller, and Astor and overproduction, it's the idea of within the crisis of democracy, people were so entrepreneurial, had such an inventive spirit, their curiosity had maintained because they still had some sense of a liberal life.
Self-esteem.
Right, exactly.
Based on reality, not what they purchased.
Which I believe resonates back to the Mudsill theory that Gatto mentioned, where people had such independent livelihoods, it's impossible to have a manufacturing core within America. Still yet, plenty of people and farmers were inventing all over the place because they had natural curiosity into the natural sciences, which what physics and all these things were called back then, because they were kind of amalgamated into one kind of school of thought. They had more of an integration. But what's interesting with the overproduction aspect, if you can think of some of the effects of that, if people want to look to some of the effects of that, to some small degree, is in the documentary The Light Bulb Conspiracy, I believe, and obsolescent manufacturing.
That's an excellent documentary.
Right. Yeah, excellent documentary to kind of show some of the effects of what happened. And then later, I believe Lisa will kind of spell out some of the underlying philosophy. And
but I think a lot was just said there, both beside what Paul said, beside what Tony said, beside what Jan said. It needs to be explained a little bit in context. First off, there's the metaphor of controlling people by training fleas. He's talking about being the metaphorical lid on the jar that breaks the curiosity of the kids so that their natural powers are alien to them going on in life, because you've been given this pseudo information that cuts off your curiosity, because you stop thinking when you think you know what's going on. The teacher thinks they know because they have this official book with the official answers, so they feel real smart. You're right. No one ever questions the validity of the things in the textbooks when you're a kid, because you're under the belief that you're being taught by an authority that is 100% absolutely certain, and that there's nothing up to, you know, historical dispute on these things. The second thing would be that the reason that von Clausewitz, in this famous military tome that's taught in every major military academy around the world, the reason he's talking about Kabbalah is because they needed to figure out how man's mind works. And they found this symbolic metaphor of a method that has been used for thousands of years successfully by a small group of people who, by the way, had professionally been kicking everybody's proverbial rear end around.
It's the ancient form of the study of psychology, in a way, and how to manipulate people's emotions and their quote-unquote subtle body and all these different things to gain what they want out of the situation, which is perfect in the Hermeticism and the Hegelian dialectic and these pairs of opposites dueling all the time, you know.
That's the Roman Collegia and Mark Antony not using grammar, logic, and rhetoric, but rather using his appeals to emotion, because he knows that the crowd is irrational and he has no time to educate them or be logical. He needs to make sure that everyone knows that Brutus just killed Caesar and that Caesar loved you people and this whole thing, right? So that is the power of being able to use words to manipulate people, and that is very much part of the crowd control that goes on to this day, whether it's politics on TV or politics in person or any of these things, the economic pseudo-experts that have been presented to us by the people who are stealing the money. But I digress. So all of these things come together, and it's not any one of our sentences that's ever going to make it click, I don't think. It's when you take everything we're saying and start to break it down in the notes, because we're listing everything that we talk about through these episodes and everything that John talks about through these episodes all in the notes. So I think there's around 500 footnotes for episode 43, right? Yes. And we're still editing 44 while we're recording 45. So that's the production of our lives. Kevin, do you have some words on overproduction, the influence of corporate foundations, corporate personhood, and the type of weight and stress and leverage that can be placed upon a small country like America, who's only a couple hundred years old?
Absolutely. Well, I'd like to enter in what I found last night in the Congressional Record.
Oh, what's that? What's a Congressional Record? Well, is that in the Library of Congress or something?
Yeah.
Where would you get something like that?
Yeah, this is the United States of America Congressional Record, Proceedings and Debates of the 76th Congress, Third Session. And this was Honorable Jacob Thorkelson of Montana in the House of Representatives, Monday, August 19th, 1940. Mr. Thorkelson says, "Mr. Speaker, in order that the American people may have a clearer understanding of those who over a period of years have been undermining the Republic in order to return it to the British Empire, I have inserted a record of a number of articles to prove this point. These articles are entitled Steps Towards British Union, a World State and International Strife." And in this document, he goes on to explain in great detail what Carol Quigley would put into Tragedy and Hope. Later on, how the
20 years later.
Right. How the Cecil Rhodes Milner Roundtable was trying to reincorporate the United States into an Atlantic bloc with Germany in the lead. And he also ties this into the Pilgrim Society, which was having its 10th anniversary at the time that this was being written. And he also ties it into the Grand Orient of France and the Lodge of the Nine Sisters and a lot of the Masonic lodges that were undoubtedly taken over by members of the Illuminati. And this can all be verified and referenced in the notes.
I hear a lot of blah, blah, blah. Can you read me a quote out of there?
Sure. These articles are entitled Steps Towards British Union, a World State and International Strife. This is part one, and in this I include a hope expressed by Andrew Carnegie in his book entitled Triumphant Democracy. In this, he expresses himself in this manner. "Let men say what they will. I say that as surely as the sun in the heavens once shone upon the British and America united, so surely it is that one morning to rise, to shine upon, to greet again, the reunited states, the British American Union." This statement is clear, and the organizations which Mr. Carnegie endowed have spent millions in order to bring this about. This thing has been made possible by scholarships, exchange professors, subsidies of churches, subsidies of educational institutions, all of them working for the purpose of eliminating Americanism, as was once taught in our schools, and to gradually exchange this for an English version of our history. These organizations were organized to bring about a British Union, a union in which the United States would again become part of the British Empire. However, this has been upset to some extent by an attempt of internationalists to establish their own government as international or world union. And he goes on to quote from Drifting Together. He enters the whole paper into the record by Andrew Carnegie, written October 14th, 1904. It's entitled Drifting Together, Will the United States and Canada Unite?
Is this the same Carnegie that is like trying to take over the education system
and
working with the Rockefellers, and that Norman Dodd said they went and inspected their records and they got all these crazy ideas that are very un-American? So my question is it one if by land, two if by sea, three if by internet? Because the British are already here. They've not only come, they're in the congressional record. Like, people have tried to talk about this before, and what happened? No one heard about it. This is going on, and the more we dig into it, the more proof we find, the more we actually learn about the history of our own country. So this is kind of fascinating. Why wouldn't they teach us in a public school?
And I'll read a couple sections. I'll read a couple sections.
Taking
from
the question, that's a fallacy, my bad.
I'll read a couple of sections from Drifting Together by Andrew Carnegie. "Britain and America being now firmly agreed that those attempted to tax the American colonies against their protest were wrong, and that in resisting this, the colonists vindicated their rights as British citizens, and therefore only did their duty. The question arises, is a separation forced upon one of the parties and now deeply regretted by the other to be permanent? I cannot think so, and crave permission to present some considerations in support of my belief that the future is certain to bring reunion of the separated part, which will probably come about this way. Those born north and south of the imaginary line between Canada and the United States, being all Americans, must soon merge. It were as a great folly to remain divided as England and Scotland who have done so." Later on, he mentions Cecil Rhodes directly. The peaceful union of Canada and America would lead Britain to a serious view of her position, resulting in the conclusion that Cecil Rhodes reached. It will be remembered that he was the first strong British imperialist. Mr. Stead recounts that Mr. Rhodes went to Lord Rothschild and laid the scheme before him, who replied, "This is all very well if you can get America to join. If not, it amounts to nothing." This led Mr. Rhodes to have said the result was what he saw clearly, that Lord Rothschild was right. British Federation would leave Britain as a member of a smaller part of her own race and out of the main channel of progress as the mother among hundreds of millions of her own children, composing all of the fraction of the English-speaking men. Hence, he abandoned the scheme, supposedly, and therefore thereafter favored race federation and left to America more scholarships than all other lands. He saw that it was the way to the Republic, not to the British settlements. His country had to look for the coming reunion of his race, with Britain in her rightful place of parent of them all. A few figures will leave no room for a dispute about this. And it goes in to state the statistics of the time of the populations of America, Canada, and Great Britain.
So give us a highlight of some of the other hot spots in that particular congressional record from 1940.
Sure. After entering Carnegie's document, which I was just reading from, Mr. Thorkelson enters on August 19, 1940. "Mr. Speaker, we are now dominated and plagued by various pressure groups that care little or nothing about the United States as long as they can involve us in the present European war. Some of these groups are well known, others remain obscure, but nevertheless very powerful and effective in their insidious attempt to convince the people of this nation that war is impeding. These groups are composed of members who are generally classed as the intelligentsia." Who created the word intelligentsia? That would have been Bronislaw Trentowski, one of the founders of cybernetics.
B.F. Trentowski, 1843, and my reference would be Fire in the Minds of Men, Origins of Revolutionary Faith by James H. Billington, who's not only a Rhodes Scholar, but he's also a Librarian of Congress.
And I would also look into Ampère, who had similar ideas based on Plato's Republic and the need for a steersman.
And remember that last week we discussed Gordon Wasson's wife, Valentina Pavlovna Wasson, and she was Russian intelligentsia.
You're right. Very astute observation.
He continues, "I should not question their intelligence, but if one is to judge them by what they have said and done, their intelligence is not being directed for the greater interest of the United States. Aiding these groups, I believe, often innocently, are those whom we may take the liberty of calling their tools and servants. We have reached a stage where these Anglophiles advance the thought that in order to qualify as a good American, one must be pro-English and willing to fight and die for England. These England First groups and many hands across the sea organizations are made up of many Canadian and Anglo-American societies, which are located in many cities across the United States and larger cities. One of these, which I will now refer, is the Pilgrims. When the Pilgrims were organized in 1902 to aid in developing Anglophiles in the United States, the Canadians, being British subjects, were not solicited at first as members of this charitable and exclusive propaganda service to sell America in the British Empire. Like converts, many of these members were more loyal to England than British themselves. In their fanatical zeal to serve Albion, I am informed by a subject that one of them placed the English crown on the flagstaff of Columbia University."
You mean King's College?
Yes, I do.
That's what Columbia University used to be called.
"If this is true, the Columbia alumni should crown him who gave the orders for mounting it and replace the crown with the eagle so this noble emblem can rest in its rightful place. The Pilgrim membership may be found in our military organization and in our government."
What, sir, is Albion?
Albion means of British, and it refers to a territory north of Britain. I would add that there is a Albion, Illinois, which was created by British settlers, and it is a home to many manufacturing bases that would be considered by Gatto to be based on the British model of mechanism.
It's fascinating.
The article continues discussing much of what Porter Sargent and Carol Quigley would say later on. In fact, Porter Sargent was of this time, of 1940.
And his 1940 book was called?
War and Education and Getting Us into War by Porter Sargent.
It's a very tragedy and hope-esque book 20 years before Quigley had written anything down, so we thought at first maybe he was a plagiarist. But the sources and materials seem to be similar but independent.
And he also was a distributor for handbooks for private schools, which is very interesting.
Very fascinating.
In his book on page 29... in the chapter Causes Working for War, the easiest solution of the economic problem for Germany would be special economic arrangements in Central Europe. Germany and the smaller countries to the east and south are largely economical, correlative, and the present excessive economic subdivision of Eastern Europe cannot be permanent. This Lothian, Lord Lothian, Philip Kerr, wrote in an article in the 19th century.
Wait a minute, isn't he part of the Cecil Rhodes Roundtable?
Yes, he is, in Milner Kindergarten. And at Chatham House, June 29, 1937, speaking of the smaller nations of Europe, he said, "Their greatest need is that Central Europe should settle down, and that is only possible, in my view, under German leadership. I think it must be admitted that National Socialism has done a great deal for Germany. It has undoubtedly cleaned up Germany in the ordinary moral sense of the word. It has given discipline and order and a sense of purpose to the great majority of young people who in the earlier days did not know what they were living for."
That was from what page of what book?
That is from Getting Us Into War by Porter Sargent, 1940, which was published as a private collection. And he lays out much of what Carol Quigley does on the Cecil Rhodes Milner Roundtable Group, except he's doing this as it's happening and shortly thereafter.
So, if I may speak into the record, kind of context on crowd control, from Chapter 2 by Moscow and Pareto, from the book entitled Sociology of the Elites, the ruling class, Gaetano Mosca. Gaetano Mosca was the first theorist to attempt an in-depth sociology of the elites. By Mosca's key ideas find expression in the second chapter of his main work entitled The Ruling Class. This chapter begins with Mosca's most quoted sentence. "Among the constant facts and tendencies of the life of a state, one is so obvious that it is apparent to the most casual eye. In all societies, from societies that are very meagerly developed and have barely attained the dawnings of civilization, down to the most advanced and powerful societies, two classes of people appear. A class that rules, and a class that is ruled. The first class, always the less numerous, performs all political functions, monopolizes power, and enjoys the advantages that power brings, whereas the second, the more numerous class, is directed and controlled by the first, in a manner that is now more or less legal, now more or less arbitrary and violent, and supplies the first, in appearance at least, with the material means of subsistence and with the instrumentalities that are essential to the vitality of the political organism."
All right, so I was doing my homework for the Gatto interview, and I was going through all his books and all his lectures, and I keep hearing him talk about these guys, Vilfredo, Pareto, and Mosca. Gaetan Mosca, I think is his name. So Pareto and Mosca. And a couple times I couldn't hear, so I had trouble getting the spelling, but when I found out who he was talking about, what he was alluding to, and I started reading the primary sources, I was blown away that back in the 1800s, these two guys come up with a similar theory, and they put them together, and they're like, hey, there is an elite ruling class here, and here's what makes us different, here's what makes the people we rule and manage over different, and this is the dividing line that is the wealth gap, the knowledge gap, the power gap. This is the reason that they hide this useful secret information.
If I can continue on quickly, I just realized here, this universal principle is not, in Mosca's view, invalidated by universal suffrage and parliamentarism. In his chapter on suffrage, he states explicitly that, despite appearances to the contrary, in a quote-unquote representative system, there is, just as in any other form of government, an organized minority which imposes its will on the disorganized majority. Those elected are, he further notes, not as a rule the representatives of the majority, who simply delegate their power to them for a given period of time, but are part of the ruling minority. There is therefore no reason whatsoever to speak of the government by the majority. Using the paired terms organized and unorganized, Mosca again refers to one of the two points which he made immediately after the basic proposition cited above, and which he views as crucial evidence of the inevitability of the rule of the minority over the majority. This, as he noted there, is quote-unquote inevitable, quite simply because, for one thing, the former are, quote, organized, and the latter are, quote, unorganized, end quote. A minority, as he continues, is, as it were, organized by definition, for the simple reason that it is easier for 100 people to, quote-unquote, act in concert than it is for 1,000. The larger the state, and hence the smaller the ruling minority in relation to the population, the easier it is, as a consequence, for the minority to secure its rule. The second reason Mosca cites is that ruling minorities generally consist of individuals who are superior to the mass of the ruled in both material and intellectual terms. It is this superiority, together with moral prestige, which he sees as being the central means required to lead the masses.
And now if you follow along, if you click the notes, if you read that for yourself, if you think it over in your mind, it'll start to make sense that there's a good reason we weren't taught this in public schools, but that doesn't mean it's not going on in objective reality, because when you get into the primary documents, when you read the letters, when you read their books, I'm talking about the intelligentsia. When we say the they, you can refer to David Rothkopf's book, Superclass, because he lists the 6,000 people who are most influential in the international economy. So it's not like we're talking about a nebulous they or something called a New World Order. The New World Order is an agenda carried out by many groups of people that they all subscribe to this international society where there are no national borders. There is one world currency manipulated by one central bank, one central hill of justice, if you will, and one plan that has been successively carried out century after century with such coherency. And when you look for the source of this plan, you come across people like Cecil Rhodes and the De Beers Cartel and the Oxford Roundtable Group, which spawns out the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilaterals and the Bilderberg Group, and has control over all of our media that we see every day, has control over our school system, our colleges, our corporations, because when you get into Clint Richardson's works on the comprehensive annual financial reports, you see that all these corporations are all interbreeding with each other, that all of our communities are actually corporatized, that they're owned by other communities, and these communities also own the corporations. So when you're looking for the who of this, beyond these groups of exact people with membership lists who publish magazines, etc., you can also look into who is interbreeding all this corporate personhood. How did that originate? What myth is that based on? Southern Pacific Railroad versus Santa Clara County. I think it's 1896, and it's a misnomer in the clerk's note on the top. If you read the judge's actual decision, corporations do not have the same rights as people. What effect does that have on this country over the past 100 years? These are all questions that arise just from the first 15 minutes of hour 5 of the Ultimate History Lesson. But we will be right back, and this is minutes 15 through 30.
The Trilateral Commission gave me the break I needed to understand this more precisely. They underwrote the publication of a book called The Crisis of Democracy in 1975, published by New York University Press, in which you have to have training in reading between the lines, because the sophisticated power brokers aren't nakedly making these statements. But if you read Crisis of Democracy carefully, you will see that the crisis is too many people took it seriously and translated the principles into action and cost the industries and the hierarchy a war that, you know, now the next war would be harder to run. I mean, to get together. It would be more absurd. At least you could make a case in those jungles. But now you're going to have to make a case in the arid deserts of Iraq or in the mountains of Afghanistan. Why? National security depends on suppressing these barefoot people and people whose weapons are blowing up their feet and their underwear. Hey, you know, they're going to take the bread out of your family's mouth. I remember the attempt in Nicaragua under the Sandinistas to communicate the idea that it was just a stone's throw from our southern border, and these people might pile into their 20 and 30-year-old vehicles, and that'd be this 1,000-mile drive north, and an into Texas they'd come. Well, you know, we our economy, of course, cannot function without warfare. So that when these things are over, count on the fact that if we have to attack the South Pole, the penguins will are clear and present danger.
In the Paris Peace Conference, 1919, pre-CFR formation, Colonel House and these characters are hanging out, and Ho Chi Minh comes in and says, "We want to be free like America. We love democracy. We want to do this." And instead of helping them out, helping them to become free, They're like, well, we're going to have to take them out. That makes a good place to have a
war. We need enemies. We have to have enemies. The interesting thing about the book, The Crisis of Democracy, is that spreading out like ripples from a stone thrown in a pond, the popular magazines and press, Time Magazine did a cover story on too much democracy, question mark. Of course, they concluded, you bet, in a complicated, high-tech world, you can't allow non-experts to make decisions there. But it was everywhere. So the tom-toms, they're interconnected, and they beat simultaneously or nearly so.
What's the role of curiosity?
Well, is it not the lever that produces invention? I mean, it forces you really in a fun way to think for yourself there. And then it turns out that the secrets of nature or of society aren't really very hard to penetrate as long as you remain curious. How do you destroy curiosity? Because we all say little babies are always curious. How do you destroy curiosity? Well, one good way is to sit people in chairs, tell them to speak when you're spoken to, threaten them with upcoming tests if they don't memorize usually erroneous material. It's fascinating. Show me a school book that deals with Admiral Perry's opening of Japan. And the school book, last one I looked, was nominally under the aegis of the Librarian of Congress, so a major scholar. And it will say that, essentially it will say that we decided that Japan should be part of the modern world. It wasn't fair to leave them in medieval. And so Admiral Perry sailed over there and negotiated, and they said, okay, you can have coaling bases, or we'll take care of sunken whaler crews. What no one says is that Perry had 11-inch naval rifles, the standard of the day. The Japanese had medieval cannon with a range of about 75 yards, and Perry's guns could reach 10 miles. And that Perry emphasized the destructive impact of his force of three black gunboats. I mean, somebody had to actually paint the boats black by destroying some structures on the shore. Then they rode out fast enough and said, you know, please, massa.
When did the American dream become one of lifelong servitude and debt slavery?
It's so fascinating that the American dream is enunciated in 1859 by Abraham Lincoln speaking to the Wisconsin Agricultural Associations. That's 152 years ago. And he says the American dream is to write your own script, to have an independent livelihood. That's why we don't have giant corporations like Britain and Germany have. People only work for somebody else long enough to put a stake together, and they figure out what people need, and then they do. So the American dream was, as elementary school books, it was liberty, freedom, personal sovereignty, and it was rather unique in the history of political nations around the earth, or even tribal bodies. And did it work? It almost immediately propelled us into a paramount position among the, just because there's a, I'm not hostile to, but I'm also a stranger to IT and and the high-tech world. But I do try to keep up with the theory of what's going on. And about 3 or 4 years ago, there was a wonderful analytical book called The Cathedral and the Bazaar. Are you familiar with it?
I don't remember who wrote it.
At all. And I read it and I saw almost immediately what I thought nature was about proving itself through IT. The author or authors maintain that the crowd collectively has more wisdom and insight collectively, and gave some hair-raising examples. A huge gold ore body in Canada was discovered by the company putting its limited, it knew that there had to be an ore body there, but it also knew that if it used the normal procedures and the hole proved dry, excuse the mixed metaphor there, that they would be exhausted and they would have to sell what they knew. It's Goldcorp today, GG on the exchange. So how did they discover the ore body? Instead of going to the recognized engineers and blowing all their wad on one shot, on the internet, they globally put out to anyone at all, from any background at all, they wanted a theory of how to find that ore body. And somebody who had nothing to do with mining, pick up the book, because I'm losing the richness of the details.
But it's the essence of how non-experts can make some of the biggest discoveries.
Oh, well. There is a book, I made a note to bring up here. There's a book that used to be required reading at MIT, and maybe still would be. It's by a middle-level physicist named Robert Scott Root Bernstein. It's called Creativity. It's this thick, and the structure internally is so maddening. It's done in the form of a group discussion among different people why he did that. But eventually I forced myself to read it, and what just comes pouring out of it is how actual life world-changing discoveries are made. This is an MIT textbook. Apparently, by adding funds and assistance to a project, you almost destroy your ability to make these breakthroughs. People who have to saw ice cube trays in half to make a piece of lab equipment, etc., etc., are the people who transcend the conventional. Now, that's often then taken over by a big project. One of the most recent dramatic examples, and I'm sure you can Google or whatever the search engine term is, there was a 2 or 3 years ago in 60 Minutes, there was an account of a new way to treat cancerous tumors with radiation without any side effects at all, and it had been discovered by a man in his garage who was had nothing to do with cancer research.
John Canzius is who you're talking about, right?
Who?
John Canzius?
Yes, Canzius.
And he worked in radio and television. And he
was a kid. He was an enthusiast. And he knew that if you shot radio waves through metal, that it heated up, and he wondered if it would kill a tumor but not leave the devastation that radiation does. And in fact, it did. Now, we don't have to take it on faith. The leading cancer researchers in the world said, this is a whole new ball game. you know, and some key research hospitals and took the process over. And Canisius's motivation was he was in the terminal stages of cancer himself, and he knew that the established treatments wouldn't help him. And in fact, he was too far gone and he died. I think the thing is at UPittsburgh now, but it's some major universities. But I heard the reigning expert in the world say this is makes all the past, you know, irrelevant. But that's a commonality. I copied some notes out of the Ruth Bernstein book. He said that intensive and narrow scientific training will guarantee that you never make a scientific breakthrough. You know, you can get the best Johns Hopkins, it doesn't matter. It's the narrowness of training. The people who make these breakthroughs have as wide a range of mental and physical tools as possible. They almost invariably play musical instruments, are good at languages, etc., etc. Most successful people in physics make it by going off by themselves and learning whatever they want to, not following the history of the physical sciences. What they learn from mentors is how to deal with ambiguity. But the established bodies of scientific knowledge get in the way of thinking afresh. You know, as soon as you hear these things, they're so commonsensical, you say, of course, why didn't I think of that? Just a couple more here. Virtually every scientific pioneer, men like Edison, Franklin, Einstein, Planck, Maxwell, many others, had early opportunities to do absolutely independent research. All of them were in their early 20s, which has given rise to an understanding in the higher levels of the sciences that if you haven't made a major breakthrough by your middle 20s, you're not going to. What you can do is head up a project and be a bureaucrat and take credit, as many college professors do, for the discoveries of your students, but you're not going to be worth gambling on. It isn't the age in itself that limits insight. It's the imprint of rigid patterns of habits.
Welcome back to Peace Revolution. This is hour 5 of the Ultimate History Lesson, minutes 15 through 30. John started off by mentioning the Trilateral Commission and something called the Crisis of Democracy, and how the managerial class had become aware through the events and the protests during and following the Vietnam War that the people, the crowd, was becoming harder to manage. And why were they so hard to manage? Well, they had these things instilled by Abraham Lincoln and our grandparents and our parents called the American Dream, which was to write our own script in life. We live in America. We were brought up with certain beliefs, which may or may not be true historically, but doesn't mean we can't evolve to learn our history and actually come to learn how to write our own script in life. Because, as John says in, I believe, Weapons of Mass Instruction, you either learn to write your own script in life, or by default, you unwittingly become an actor in someone else's script. So I think what he's showing is it's not the memorization of material in public schools that builds character and builds experience and gives us the faith to have a method to call upon to meet and surmount mental and physical challenges in our life, which would lead to understanding, calmness, logical, reasonable thinking all the time. Instead, he's saying you're getting pushed into a state of mind where you're emotionally reactive, where you're confused, where you're fearful, where you're frustrated, where your anger turns into aggression. And that's all caused because the methodology by which we could dispel confusion, which he mentions in hour 3 and 4, the trivium, is not offered to public school children. And the word school
indicates that free will has been taken out of the education process. So by learning that children's lives are developing heavily in the first 10 years of their life, and the fact that you could be instilling them with the experience, teaching them foreign languages, doing all sorts of things that the public school would never imagine to do, because what you're trying to do as a parent is build a respectful, responsible person who can protect themselves from predators, who knows how to love themselves, and knows how to protect themselves from people who haven't figured out how to be kind to themselves and be kind to the others, right? And be cooperative and work together and try to be constructive. It's all too easy to become frustrated, fearful, angry, and then turn aggressive and destructive. And the people that are the managerial class are of that mindset. That's why they're the minority. They're not like us, because they have a philosophy that allows them to prey. What's a better word for it, guys? What's a better word for what they do to us? I mean, manage us like livestock. I mean, that's a rancher metaphor, but it's still kind of kind for what is actually going on, since they attack our children first.
Well, if it's a farm operation and we're the livestock, then they have to keep us in a position where we can be constantly milked, right? So, you know, whether that's a farmer, rancher, or it's a form of predation, because it's not like we have a choice in the matter, right? If we don't give them our milk, our biweekly milk, or a percentage of it, then eventually they put our name on a list, which then, you know, eventually they try and imprison us or send guys with guns to our house to force us to give them our milk. So...
Well, I mean, the fact is, these are people who practice the dark arts of deception, call it dark shamanism, call it evil, call it what you will. John refers to them as the sophisticated power brokers, and there's a myriad of different types of power that they are brokering. He talks about having to learn to read between the lines, that even though much of what the upper ruling managerial class, however you want to refer to them, have left behind, much of it is very explicit when you get into the source materials. But he's saying, if you're going to look at what's going on today, you also have to look at the subtext, because they're not being as explicit anymore, because they are aware that people are starting to catch on to the reality of this myth that they've been able to perpetrate for well over 100 years in front of the American population in full view. It's just that no one brought their attention to it, made it specific, and that's what John has also spoken about. His process of realization, coming across more and more of these so-called anomalies, only to find out they're not anomalies. That's the actual picture. And what he's been taught, those items of memory which he had been taught and taken as logical anchors to reality, didn't actually have the definition and knowledge to support them. And thus he would have to cast aside these childish beliefs, because as he argued with himself over and over to figure out what the truth actually was, he had to decide that what he had been taught was not a map which is reflective of reality, and therefore what each of us needs to do in order to avoid these purposely placed pitfalls is to make our own map. And while we're making a map for ourselves, hey, why not share the information with each other so that we can make our maps better, faster? And that's the only way we're going to get organized and have an equal chance in this.
Speaking of the unorganized becoming organized, John mentions this document or book called The Crisis of Democracy, which was published in 1975. And it's in reference to his discussing hyper-democracy and too many people taking democracy seriously, and those people beginning to understand how to form alliances with one another to confront power with power, etc. So this document, which is over 200 pages, and I haven't read it in its entirety, but I came across several sections which I think reflect what John was expressing. Now, this is chapter 3, entitled The United States, written by Samuel P. Huntington. Some background on who Samuel Huntington is. He is Frank G. Thompson Professor of Government at Harvard University and Associate Director of Harvard's Center for International Affairs. He is also a founder and editor of the quarterly journal Foreign Policy.
He also wrote Class of Civilizations.
Exactly. And on page 59 of the book, under the first section, The Vitality and Governability of American Democracy, he writes, "The 1960s witnessed a dramatic renewal of the democratic spirit in America. The predominant trends of that decade involved the challenging of the authority of established political, social, and economic institutions. increased popular participation in and control over those institutions. And to skip ahead, because it's a long document, the 1960s also saw, of course, a marked upswing in other forms of citizen participation in the form of marches, demonstrations, protest movements, and quote-unquote cause organizations. The expansion of participation throughout society was reflected in the markedly higher levels of self-consciousness on the part of blacks, Indians, Chicanos, white ethnic groups, students, and women, all of whom became mobilized and organized in new ways to achieve what they considered to be their appropriate share of the action and of the rewards. Moving on, previously passive or unorganized groups in the population now embarked on concerted efforts to establish their claims to opportunities, positions, rewards, and privileges, which they had not considered themselves entitled to before. In a related and similar fashion, the 1960s also saw a reassertion of the primacy of equality as a goal in social, economic, and political life. The meaning of equality and the means of achieving it became central subjects of debate in intellectual and policy-oriented circles. Differences in wealth and power were viewed with increased skepticism, and skipping ahead, this intellectual concern over equality did not, of course, easily transmit itself into widespread reduction of inequality in society. But the dominant thrust in political and social action was all clearly in that direction. Now, he goes on to say, under Section 3, the decline in governmental authority, which is on page 74, the essence of the democratic surge of the 1960s was a general challenge to existing systems of authority, public and private. In one form or another, this challenge manifested itself in the family, the university, business, public and private associations, politics, etc. He goes on to say, people no longer felt the same compulsion to obey those whom they had previously considered superior to themselves in age, rank, status, expertise, character, or talents. Within most organizations, discipline eased and differences in status became blurred. Each group claimed its right to participate equally. More precisely, in American society, authority had been commonly based on organizational position, economic wealth, specialized expertise, legal competence, or electoral representatives. Authority based on hierarchy, expertise, and wealth all obviously ran counter to the democratic and egalitarian temper of the times, and during the 60s, all three came under heavy attack. And continuing, in a democracy, the authority of governmental leaders and institutions presumably depends in part on the extent to which the public has confidence and trust in those institutions and leaders. The democratic surge involved a more politically active citizenry, which developed increased ideological consistency on public issues and which then lost its confidence in public institutions and leaders when governmental policies failed to correspond to what they desired. So he's describing the crisis as people becoming self-conscious, self-aware, wanting to be autonomous.
Henry Luce's LSD experiment on America went a little too far, and they're like, hey, people are a little too awake, and they're starting to realize that there's a power structure, that we manage them, that we're conditioning them, and they didn't like that. So they put this crisis of democracy, the crisis of democracy document together. And what's the full title? Who's it? It's a report of some sort? How's that go?
The full title is The Crisis of Democracy, Report on the Governability of Democracies to the Trilateral Commission.
So the question is, what or who is the Trilateral Commission? When was it founded? Who were its founders? What are its goals and doctrines? And are there any characters familiar to this story that John has been talking about on education in the form of the ultimate history lesson? Specifically, I remember David Rockefeller being a founder, along with Jimmy Carter and Zbigniew Brzezinski, and those names have come up several times during this conversation, especially that Rockefeller family. They seem to have a lot of influence, not only in medical establishments and education, but also in politics. I believe I've seen a poster someplace of Nelson Rockefeller running for president, and wasn't he vice president during the 70s when this document's being written? I'm just saying, if you look at everything in context, there's some patterns of history that schools of the public variety definitely cannot teach you, and that it's a lot more fun to teach yourself these things and to hang out with friends and do these sort of games and figure out what's really going on than it is to sit around and play that fantasy football stuff.
You mentioned Zbigniew Brzezinski, and he was director of the Trilateral Commission at the time, and also the authors consulted him on this document.
And he's also advisor to President Obama. That's how Obama got in office, because Brzezinski's his handler ever since Afghanistan in the 80s. But I digress. John also talks about how individual curiosity is lost, resourcefulness is lost when we conform to the public school system, and that we don't have the experience to overcome or work through the ambiguity because we have no method to meet and surmount our mental and physical challenges. And without that, we can't attain mental or physical health or balance. And if they can keep us off balance by denying us that which we need to survive and thrive in this world, and they can occult or keep that information secret from us over long periods of time to the point where we don't even remember that it existed, let alone, you know, have a way of getting it back. Here we are in the middle of experiencing the use of these methods returning and what we're discovering as a result of asking the questions of what are we actually sensing with our five senses? What knowledge can we attain from that? How do these individual pieces of knowledge connect into a body of logical, non-contradictory communication that we can then share and embolden everybody with a more accurate map of reality than that which is being handed out in any school for any price?
To sum up a little bit of what we've all been saying here, what it comes down to then is this independent livelihood. Leading up to the American Revolution and after the American Revolution, you had these independent livelihoods which were a threat, and the British were not able to implement their mechanistic systems of labor. And at the same time, there were Prussian and then German forces that were trying to implement their systems of control based on cybernetic visions. And this is something that was very, very much inherent in what Jan was saying with the Kabbalah and with cybernetics and B.F. Trentowski. Now, this German political science that took place, that was imported into the United States, was called Staatswissenschaft. And its goal, maybe I should just let Andrew Dixon White do the talking. The founders of
the Yale Skull and Bones, Andrew Dixon White of the Yale Troika?
Yes, that would be Andrew Dixon White, who also went to the Carnegie Castle to discuss with Carnegie about creating the Carnegie Institute of Science that Daniel Coit Gilman, the incorporator of the Skull and Bones Trust, would then be the president of.
And if you're listening and you find that interesting, there will be Anthony Sutton links in the notes for America's Secret Establishment, Introduction to Skull and Bones, Chapter 8, How the Order, being Skull and Bones, Controls Education. Back to you, Kev.
So what we've all learned is that the education system has been manipulated by this ominous continuity, and we've been able to hash out some of the sources and allusions that John Taylor Gatto wasn't able to discuss with us. Maybe he didn't have the sourcing at the time. But what we do have is that the founders of Johns Hopkins University, and I'm reading from Politics and Progress, The Emergence of American Political Science by Dennis J. Mahoney, and the first chapter is on German political science. It says, the founders of Johns Hopkins invited Andrew D. White, Andrew Dixon White of Cornell, to address them on the subject of education and political science in 1879. He, too, advocated the German model. He says, what is now proposed is no longer a new thing. In Germany, for many years, extended courses of instruction in history, politics, and social science, and general jurisprudence have been presented in various universities and had a great influence for good. It is undoubtedly true that the want of practical political instruction, the instruction which comes by taking part directly in political affairs, has presented complete and well-founded political development in Germany. But to the influence of these courses is due, in an immense degree, that excellence in German administration, which is last acknowledged and admired by the entire world. The Herren Doctrine, the Americans trained in German universities, and their students were the first professors of political science in the new American universities, just then being constructed along the German model.
Why did they not need political science before that, Kev?
Well, before that, we had independent livelihoods.
Oh, I see. They took away our independent livelihoods, our self-reliance made us dependent, and therefore needed to teach us this science of politics.
It carries on to say, the elite thus defined came in Germany of 1870 to 1890 to supply an ever-growing portion of the state officials within a state apparatus run according to fixed and logical principles to which stood above both rulers and the ruled. German political science was therefore eminently practical, and it was a political science of the administrators of the German state. And John,
so this is where all the bureaucracy and red tape comes from, and not only the school system, but the corporate system, the government system, every system that this is probably where we got marriage licenses and all these other types of licenses and permits. Wow, this makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and a historian, Herbst, called this a transfer of culture. What they sought out to do with this new American political science and the association built around it was very similar to what they did with the American Historical Association and Andrew Dixon White. The goal was that progress as a whole is enshrined in the state and human happiness is secondary. So the crisis of democracy, which Lisa talked about, was when people are waking up and they were starting to see that, wow, systems can in fact have integrity. Wow, we don't have to participate with all systems. We have volition.
So it sounds like one system is sacrifice of the individual to the state, and the other system was the crisis of democracy where people were discovering, hey, I am an individual. Everyone else is an individual. This idea of a state or a government or any of these things, these are mythical collective concepts. They are not percepts. You cannot perceive government directly. Only agents of government and all these indirect, manufactured, contrived mechanisms of the bureaucracy. And so I think the best reference for that I've heard is, Jan, your podcast had an interview with Larkin Rose where he went through a dialogue to explain that to people. What number is that?
Let me pull that up here real quick, Rich.
While you pull it up, Rich, sure. I'm just going to say one of the key concepts I think that is being alluded to here is the idea of the violation of volition. And
can you define volition?
Do you have the volitional sciences book? your ability, it's not just free will, but your free will to choose. So you have both a willful aspect and
inherent right.
And informed consent.
And informed consent, exactly.
Okay, Larkin Rose's interview was episode number 115.
And what's the title of it?
Dialectic and the Myth of Government.
Excellent.
I would like to add that John Dewey reported that Germany is the modern state which provides the greatest facilities for general ideas to take effect through social instruction. Its system of ideas is adapted to that end. Higher schools and universities are really, just not nominally, under the control of the state and part of the state life. Moreover, one of the chief functions of the university is preparation of future state officers.
That's the propaedeutic function he'll talk about in a few minutes.
Legislative activity is distinctly subordinate to that of administration conducted by trained civil service, or if you please, bureaucracy. Membership in this bureaucracy is dependent upon university training. The American students who sought out this experience not only sat at the feet of the intellectual leaders of the German nation, but also sat among the young men who would shortly be carrying on the daily business of the German Empire. Even this does not fully describe the position of the university in the German political order. Dewey ascribed it to the function of creating and molding public opinion. He said, public opinion hardly exists in Germany in the sense in which it obtains in France, Great Britain, or this country. So far as it exists, the universities may be said to be its chief organs. They, rather than the newspapers, crystallize it and give it articulate expression.
Very well said.
So ask me this. If one of the key concepts I think people really need to kind of ponder and speculate upon is the idea of the concept of the violation of volition. And if we define volition as your free will to choose, you have informed consent and to choose by your own volition, your own free will to make a choice whether or not through informed consent you want to include yourself within whatever agreement you're deciding to go upon. So that being said, if humanity is natural predators, how would the predators go about masking themselves and incorporating all of these different machinations we see all over the place?
Wolves in sheep's clothing.
Exactly. And that comes up with, it just reminded me of a conversation we had earlier, where they may dress like us, speak like us, act like us, but in fact, they are natural predators. And that's the idea of dark shamanism, if magic is nothing more than the manipulations of words and symbols to control people's minds, and we can see how effective all this behaviorism and all these different machinations has been in controlling the mind of man, and how it has been used to engender this plot towards a movement towards one world government or whatever it be, but a state of control over where a very small minority, like I mentioned earlier with Mosca and Pareto, control a very large majority, which would be us.
Well, and the offering that you're making of volition or free will and informed consent as a proof, I think there's some logical underpinnings which are then formulated only upon the basic observations that existence exists, that cause and effect exists, and therefore you need to do certain things to be self-reliant and to be able to survive. You need to have ownership over the products of your labor, otherwise you're dependent on the state. So in order to be self-reliant as the people who formulated this country and endowed it to us to take care of, which we're not doing a very good job of yet, they were self-reliant. We need to be able to get back to the point where we're no longer dependent on a centralized authority or even a decentralized authority that's doing things by force, fraud, and coercion. And to understand our basic needs, we need to understand these basics of existence. We all have common needs, air, food, water, and these things have to be to a certain cleanliness. Otherwise, it causes dis-ease in our body. And recognizing these things that cause and effect exists, you can go around to anybody who doesn't understand and go over the basic grammar. Knock on their window in the house and say, what's this? And they say, well, it's a window. And what's it for? Well, it's to protect me from the cold and to protect me from people trying to steal things. Oh, people try to steal things? That's interesting. What about this? This lock. Oh, what's that to? It keeps my door from, you know, other people who don't live here. Oh, you have property? That's interesting. What's this? It's a fireplace because sometimes it gets cold. What's this? It's a motion sensor. Oh, it's because sometimes people try to break in and steal your stuff. If you go over the basic logic, they will realize that there are elements, that there's cause and effects, that there are predators. That's why they lock their car when they leave their car, because that's their possession, that's their property. They don't want other people to break in, et cetera, et cetera. So they can very rapidly understand the grammar, logic, and rhetoric that is the trivium. They can understand the methodology by which we have to start using it to protect ourselves from predators, and that we have to use this method as a function of learning to go through these primary resources to start to understand these things for ourselves and to do it in the multitudes and start sharing this information with each other, just as we're doing in these episodes.
Reading still from Politics and Progress, I would like to add page 62 of chapter 4 called Political Philosophy, where they're discussing the previous forms of political philosophy, political economy, and how that translates into the new model. Writing in 1925, Walter J. Shepard identified certain characteristics that marked the development of political science in the generation preceding his own. First among these was that the historical method has clearly won general acceptance. Metaphysical, deductive, and analytical studies of the state have not entirely disappeared, but they've been pushed into the background. For political philosophy, nature is the standard against which actual politics is to be measured. For the new political science, history was the standard. In the writings of the founders of the new political science, as in the social sciences generally, it was written, the questions of the modern state or of modern government or of the ideals of Western civilization and so forth occupy a place that was formerly occupied by the questions of the state in the right way of life. Philosophic questions have been transformed into historical questions, or more precisely into historical questions of a futuristic character. Political philosophy was replaced by political history, and for courses in political philosophy, they were substituted with such pale imitations as courses in the history of political ideas. Illustrative is the attitude of Raymond G. Gatel, who in The Problems in Political Evolution took political theory as a datum of political history. He said, the evolution of state has followed two lines, fairly distinct, yet closely interrelated. One has been the development of the state in an actual practice, the other in the field of political theory. Ordinarily, political theories are a direct result of objective political conditions. They reflect the thoughts and interpret the motives that underlie actual political development. The history of political institutions is the primary means of understanding political things. Not only did Gatel himself not attempt to understand politics theoretically, he saw the attempts of others to do so as reflections or rationalizations of political events. Although he had interest in finding the general laws and principles upon which the political development is based, Gatel was careful to warn against taking the generality of those laws and principles too seriously. On the next page it says, the doctrine or ideology of progress in one or another or several of its forms lies at the bottom of the new American political science. Humanity, culture, society, and politics are all, according to this doctrine or this ideology, constantly evolving. Newer and older replace better and worse as analytical categories. Society becomes constantly more complex, and complexity is therefore itself a guarantee of this progress. The more complex society becomes, the more government regulation is needed. Regulation is therefore also a guarantee that progress has occurred. Three forms of this doctrine or ideology of progress have been described in the preceding chapters, and their influence on the reflection in the new political science has been shown. The Prussian general state theory asserted that political communities evolve from the simple to the complex through a series of determinable stages, which stages are repeated in various societies at different times depending on the aptitude of the people for politics. The pragmatic emphasis on experimentation and description offered a methodology for this progress in politics as in other pursuits by emphasizing, quote-unquote, what works over what is consistent with assumed principles. The progressive tendency toward political reform gave the new political science an agenda that proceeded from the premise that progress could be accelerated by conscious manipulation. The common element of the various forms of the doctrine of progress is the notion that there is no good or bad, only new and old. The idea of continuous advance implies that what is most advanced is what is most preferable and is therefore to be sought. Political science might therefore consist of the identification of the direction of historical development. To know what is to be sought in politics, one must ask not how ought we to be governed or what end is to be served by politics, but what is the next step in the process of development? What is the next stage of political evolution? A political science based on the question, what is the best form of government, is irrelevant once one has embraced the doctrine of progress. Political philosophy, which asks such questions, is irrelevant, but historical and comparative studies are relevant. Speculative political theory is irrelevant, but experimental political science is relevant. It is not surprising to find that the works of the founding generation of the new political science a certain scorn and contempt for political philosophy. John W. Burgess and Woodrow Wilson, PhD from Johns Hopkins University, each dismissed the airy speculation of political philosophers who imagined that they were discovering immortal truths about the political things and who constructed past that were never to be the foundations of utopias that ever would be. The first version of this doctrine of progress to influence the new American political science was a Hegelian version, imported with the academic political science itself from the 19th century German university. A second version of this was carried over from the school of philosophy called pragmatism. One of these leading figures was John Dewey. A third version of this doctrine of progress was that of progressive movement in politics. These were the versions of this in both America and Europe. In sum, written by Nesbitt, whether in Europe or America, liberals old and new never doubted, at least until recently, that there was a progress easily to be discerned in the long struggle by man towards a release of torments, poverty, insecurity, and deprivation, and to make this release possible, toward a strongly interventionist, humanitarian, and policy-setting political state.
Okay, so what are they progressing towards? It's progression towards centralization of power, regardless of the brand of government, the supposed type. It's all about centralizing the power and the authority over the people that are being governed.
The medium is the message, and the information doesn't matter because, as Lawrence K. Frank said, it's the artistic vision of this new enduring human value that they were trying to impart. And it was also the new science of man of the Yale Institute of Human Relations and the new social psychology of Kurt Lewin of the Tavistock Institute. And all of this integrated into the cybernetic movement as they applied this to the social sciences to solidify the status quo with circular causality, where cause is effect and effect is cause in a circular motion.
Holy shit. So if I might help to translate some of what Kevin's laying down, because that's excellent, but I don't think everyone's going to grasp it right away. So here's why so many people have a hard time grasping these ideas. Because once they instill the philosophy of Kant, then you have this irrational, non-logical, non-reality, non-objective-based set of instructions or your map. And so when the map is not reflective of the objective reality, it's not really useful. But these people have developed a philosophy that's useful to them because, A, it doesn't reflect reality, and so therefore, B, they can treat you like you're a different type of being and that they have power over and that they're your god and they can make decisions to sterilize you, etc. All the crazy things that go on over history, all these war crimes, these are carried out against human beings, regardless of what part of the globe and, you know, who draw the lines and all these other things. It's human beings being dehumanized. And so to bring it all back down to earth, we have to get back to using our five senses, defining what exists, removing the contradictions, and communicating cogently. And these are not only the four steps of philosophy and the four steps of using your observations plus the three steps of the trivium. These are all the methods. When I ask John at the beginning and say, is there an easy way to learn instead of this trial and error and running around blindfolded and bumping into things, is there a way to see clearly and dispel confusion?
This is the trivium. This is what Jan has presented over many episodes of his Gnostic Media podcast. This is what the Peace Revolution has carried throughout many episodes, and we've tried to use it over and over again because we find it useful, and by sharing how we come to this information and figure all of this out and to remove the contradictions and find what exists and then communicate it, I think it's one of the most useful things that we can do is share the process that we use as we use it in presenting this information, because we have to answer all these questions as we put this material together and edit the disc set together and put the footnotes in and build out the references for each one of these podcast episodes. So there's a lot of learning going on our end, and if we don't transfer it through these episodes and share what we're finding and illustrate it for you to our best degree, then we would be wasting our time. So the idea is how to make all of our time invested herein invaluable, and that is the catalyst of us provoking you into looking at these things for yourself, because it has to sound outlandish. I've looked at this stuff for years, and I'm still surprised every day how fiendish these people who have sacrificed a lot of things in their life that are beautiful in order to follow a goal which is not only unattainable, but it's kind of inhumane and is anti-life. So it's like a cancer. But the cancer is the belief system, not the people carrying out the belief system. So we just have to give people back their volition. And I think the people who are most rabidly carrying out this cancer are probably people who need hugs and have been mistreated over their lives and have had a lot of negative energy stored up that they're trying to release on other people and fight off their own fears of scarcity by collecting billions and billions of dollars and trying to control everybody. I mean, you'd have to be in a fearful position to try to take away someone else's volition to attain your goals, and I'd say your goals really aren't that well thought out if you have to use force, fraud, and coercion to attain them.
I think the biggest illusion that people buy into is that everything's already figured out, and in that way they sacrifice their own self-reliance by thinking, you know, everything's figured out and all we're ever doing is just looking closer at the things that we've figured out. And so you don't have to look outside of that. And so in that way, you know, curiosity is discouraged in school, but the idea of necessity itself, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, that provokes the curiosity in the first place, that's been artificially satiated so that we believe we already have the answers or we accept the status quo. It's a way of channeling us into this tunnel vision so that we just kind of accept pragmatically whatever's placed in front of us, right? And why look at a wider angle view of anything, right? And so, yeah, you just look at things like they're not worth examining closer or reappraising, and you accept them at face value. And in that way, science even sabotages itself by resting so comfortably on its assumptions and previously held assertions. John talked about the Trilateral Commission, and, you know, if anyone doesn't believe in the idea of conspiracy, well, that's a group of influential individuals getting together and writing the script of society's general direction. And of course, you know, what would you do if you were in that position? You would use it to create circumstances that are friendly to your own interests, right? And it's just that we don't think on that big of a scale. But once you're there, once you're a billionaire, you start thinking on a scale of grand design, and you start organizing on a level that the common person can't even comprehend, really. But it's, in a way, they put it out there, but with all their obelisk and pyramid worship, they're putting out in plain view the symbols of the hierarchy of control. And like Tony said, they're using, you know, word magic, these consciousness manipulation symbols, to control the permutations of what we think, right? Every culture that's been taken over or co-opted, it's first done through infiltrating their language. And that's what you're seeing now in North America, where the, you know, is it torture? No, it's enhanced interrogation techniques. So it's like the Amtssprache, that you're creating new sets of symbols to redefine previously abhorrent things that nobody would accept suddenly become acceptable because you've changed the way to describe them into something quote unquote politically correct. So this crisis of democracy, is they're not afraid of democracy. That's great. You can wield a mob in any direction you want like a sword. The crisis for them is an educated mob is truly dangerous to their interests. And if they want to, you know, if you're going to have livestock, you don't want sheep that are constantly figuring out how to lift the latch to get out of the pen or how to fool the dog into not watching them. You want sheep that are as predictable and easy to manage as possible. So there's certainly a rationale behind their irrationality, but the organized elite of they're somewhat critical thinkers, I guess. They're most afraid of a rational, logical group of individuals forming alliances and organizing together, but staying decentralized, where it's not a hierarchical leadership. It's everybody's opinion matters, and how informed you are defines how much clout you have. You know what I mean? And you can tell that by talking with people. So instead of being schools of fish, we have to be like dolphins working in pods, right? Make that kind of transformation, if you want to use that analogy. Instead of being automatons, we get our autonomy back. And the last thing that I had on my notes here is the reason non-experts can come up with so many revolutionary designs is because the more expertise you have, the more the tunnel vision is closing, so you can specialize and compartmentalize. So an expert is really someone who's been compartmentalized into a very small box. And it's so small that they can describe every single little facet of this tiny little box. But if you try and challenge them with something outside of that box, or you try and reveal the connections that that box has to other boxes, they, you know, the current version of scientific philosophy denies that reality exactly.
And Dorothy Sayers made reference to the fact that many scientists become so focalized into this specific area. You know, Gatto has mentioned that there's all these inventive creativity from, you know, non-experts, just like you mentioned, Paul. And, you know, in her document, The Lost Tools of Learning, where she goes through, and I remember somewhere towards the end she mentioned how even the scientists don't even understand the basic general grammar of their own subject. They have no idea how it came to essentially came to be at that stage in history and what it means and what essentially they're doing. And, you know, that's a really important point because they essentially weren't taught. They were taught that very compartmentalized method, just enough to stay focused and maintain the status quo, which is really just maintaining another form of an irrational philosophy.
If you stack enough compartmentalized boxes together, you can stack them into the shape of a pyramid or whatever shape that you need. And no one's looking necessarily out and around at what other boxes exist to coordinate with. So it's definitely just a matter of getting outside ourselves, getting outside of our comfort zones, because if we've got this artificially mandated reality, which is constantly reaffirming us how great it is and how stable it is and trying to reinforce its own stability and existence, I guess, then you have to realize that it's essentially a machine. It's a giant ship that's been taken over by pirates, and we can either be blind rowers rowing this pirate ship as it rams into other things and takes over countries, and we're not leaving the ship to go up on the deck and see that any of this is happening because they've got such comfortable conditions down in the hold. But if we drill a hole in the side of the ship and look outside, it's like looking outside the cave and finally seeing, oh my goodness, this is what my energy has been contributing towards. I don't want to give my energy towards murder and molestation of children
Franklin cover-up is the search for that, conspiracy of silence.
The best summary I've been able to come up with that is along the lines of what you're saying. It really just comes down to being able to express value judgments when faced with, and as Gatto says, to be able to express volitional control of what groups you want to participate in. The same way that you can take the trivium and each person can apply it differently based on their own course of study. The goal was to resend humanity to a point of entropy where value judgments are no longer necessary and holding conflicting thoughts on these ideas is no longer in conflict with the self-preserving feedback.
Well, that's the solution to the cognitive dissonance, which is when you encounter something that is opposite to what you've been taught, which is what Paul was just talking about, which is how we're instilled throughout the public school system.
Right.
And maintained by the media system and industry of entertainment in our adult lives.
Entropy is kind of like a utopia where it tries to stabilize this, tries to reach this point of equilibrium with this point of nowhere. So,
and by using the trivium and by using what I would term trivenetic functionality and expressing these ideas of integrity to other people, you know, and allowing them to see that it's possible for systems to have integrity, because most people just want to accept, you know, they may say things along the lines of, well, how do you manage that many people? As Gatto says, it is our birthright in these independent livelihoods. And if you look at the history and how these different groups have tried to subvert our own free will.
And our curiosity. The lever of invention.
It's interesting how Gatto mentioned how much of a rarity it was for even America to have those, you know, couple of precious decades, if you will, of freedom, and
massive
frontier.
Invention,
right? And you see what happens.
Attitudes.
See what happens all of a sudden. Where we would be if we could find the ability to help empower others with the trivium and come to a society that can recognize common problems and come to, you know, constructive solutions to those problems.
Well, in future episode, we're going to do several episodes investigating the cancer establishments and the foundations. But after so many years of the American Cancer Society and these other groups that were started by Rockefeller and these other organizations, families, foundations, cabals, if you will, it's no wonder that the problems are not solved and that they continue to take money from people who have less in order to proliferate a fraud. When there are ways out of this, they know what's causing these things. They're putting the toxins into our environment, into our food that are causing it in the first place. But as I said, that's a future episode.
You know, it's interesting, you know, also to put it in context with what Kevin was saying, is that what Gatto was doing beforehand was earlier in the interview session is building out how all these different irrational philosophies connect. And they're not that difficult to understand, but they're just these separated pieces, fragmented pieces in history that's how it's taught. They inundate the student if you're studying philosophy in a university setting, for example, with this all these different philosophies, so you really don't have one to go on.
Well,
and
it's hard to understand because they make us incoherent, and so even if you find these dots that they're not presenting and they won't cop to, even when you confront them, as Gatto says, he just says not a good way to get tenure.
Exactly.
That's what tells them. Exactly. And he tells them nothing and at the same time tells them everything.
Right.
And without these basic things going on, there's no real progression of learning through any sort of...
Exactly. And what Kevin's trying to build out, and what Gatto says, once it gets to science, once it becomes scientific justification because of the scientific improvements that happened throughout the 18th and 19th centuries that really... in the mind of man at that time was just so powerful because of what they are seeing. I mean, electricity, for example, and railroads and the massive
expansion
of
consistency,
oil and energy.
And that takes away their fighting off the unknown every day. You have consistency with electricity. As we discovered, when it goes out, we have inconsistency, and all of a sudden you have to deal with the unknown almost 24 hours a day. And therefore, it was a lot more serene having a methodology to just – you know,
right.
Go through it and make checklists and talk to each other and figure it out. There wasn't very much panic. There was a lot of progress. But people without a methodology, well, they might have a little freak out.
Well, this has been known for thousands of years, right? And in that context, it's really simple to understand because what Gatto shows you is all these case studies really throughout history where they already understood these techniques of behavioral conditioning. All they did was formalize in a scientific understanding. So sometimes that can sound a bit complex, but really all they did with cybernetics being a steersman, just trying to control the biological machine of mankind through these closed feedback loops. It's just gathering information and then trying to control us, which has been done all throughout history. And Gatto shows you many different examples of that. And that's really the key, and that he's trying to connect all these dots. Once it came to science, though, then we seem to give over so much more to what had happened.
Well, he's just pointing to the creative potential that each and every one of us has if we hadn't gone through this system to dampen it out. But it's not completely out because you're listening to this, and only curious people would listen to something like this. So you have every chance to kind of bring a little fresh air in and enliven those sparks, and you'll be doing that over these next 15 minutes, 30 through 45 of the Ultimate History Lesson. We'll be right back.
Now, I happen to dig up a wonderful quote from William James Psychology, I think printed in 1890, and the book given credit for establishing psychology as an academic subject. And James was, of course, he had ambivalent feelings, but he certainly was a disciple of Wundt there. Now, this is a direct quote from William James' Psychology 121 years ago. Habit is the enormous flywheel of society, its most precious agent. It alone saves the children of fortune from the envious uprisings of the poor. It alone prevents the most repulsive jobs from being deserted. It holds the miner in his darkness. It keeps different social strata from mixing. Well, I'll just complete. One of the insights of discovering that really electrified me as I was reading it is how frequently the great discovery in a scientific arena is not made by the specialists in that area, by somebody from another area completely divorced who transfers into chemistry or physics, has fresh eyes, cuts through the habits that lock the mind in place, and makes the discovery. Says freedom and flexibility is much more valuable than planning. Insight comes only by getting out of ruts and plugging into a variety of methods. So these great truths, it isn't that we're discovering them now. We're taking them out of their burial places and saying, hey, look, wake up. You know, the world is much bigger and much different than you believe it is because you've been conditioned to believe it's that way. I have something here. I have the six purposes of schooling as laid down in 1917 by the man who Harvard named their honor lecture in education for. So far from being a fringe individual, this guy is the reason the Harvard honor lecture in education is named as it is, the Ingalls Lecture. Looks like Inglis, but it's pronounced Ingalls. And I would like to read you the six purposes of schooling. I moved heaven and earth, and it took years to find this book, just like trying to find in past years a copy of Carol Quigley's Tragedy and Hope. I learned about Ingalls from the 20-year president of Harvard, James Brian Conant, who was a poison gas specialist in World War I, was a very inner circle of the atomic bomb project, World War II, was the high commissioner of occupied Germany after the war. So he wrote, oh, there must be 20 books about the institution of schooling, of which he was completely a proponent. And he's a very, very bad writer. I forced myself to read most of these books. And in one of them, he says that if you really want to know what school is about, you need to pick up the book that I'm referring to here, Principles of Secondary Education. 2 years it took me to find a copy of the book, 750 pages, tiny print, and as dull as your imagination can conceive. And furthermore, it's not until you get to the very middle of the book, in an unlabeled section, that he spills the beans. Let me spill them for you. These are the six purposes or functions, as he calls them. The first he calls the adjustive function. Schools are to establish fixed habits of reaction to authority. That's their main purpose. Habits of reaction to authority. That's why school authorities don't tear their hair out when somebody exposes that the atomic bomb wasn't dropped on Korea as a history book in 1990s printed by Scott Forsman distributed, and why each of these books has hundreds of substantive errors. Learning isn't the reason the texts are distributed. So First is the adjustive function, fixed habits. Now, here comes the wonderful insight that being able to analyze a detail will give you. How can you establish whether someone has successfully developed this automatic reaction? Because people have a proclivity when they're given sensible orders to follow it. That's not what they want to reach. The only way you can measure this is to give stupid orders and people automatically follow those. Now you've achieved function one. Have you ever wondered why some of the foolish things schools do are allowed to continue? Number two, he calls it the integrating function, but it's easier to understand if you call it the conformity function. It's to make children as alike as possible, the gifted children and the stupid, as alike as possible, because market research uses statistical sampling, and it only works if people react generally the same way. The third function he calls the directive function. School is to diagnose your proper social role and then to log the evidence that here's where you are in the Great Pyramid so that future people won't allow you to escape that compartment. The fourth function is the differentiating function. Because once you've diagnosed kids in this layer, you do not want them to learn anything that the higher layers are learning. So you teach just as far as the requirements of that layer. Number five and six are the creepiest of all. Number five is the selective function. What that means is what Darwin meant by natural selection. You're assessing the breeding quality of each individual kid. You're doing it structurally because school teachers don't know this is happening. And you're trying to use ways to prevent the poor stuff from breeding, and those ways are hanging labels, humiliating labels around their neck, encouraging the shallowness of thinking, you know. I often wondered, because I came from a very, very strict Scotch-Irish culture that never allowed you to leer at a girl. Well, when I got to New York City, the boys were pawing the girls openly, and there was really no redress for the girls at all, except not showing up in the classroom. You know, high absentee rates. Well, you're supposed to teach structurally that that sexual pleasure is what you withdraw from a relationship, and everything else a waste of time and expensive. So the selective function is what Darwin meant by the favored races. The idea is to consciously improve the breeding stock. Schools are meant to tag the unfit with their inferiority by poor grades, remedial placement, humiliation, so that their peers will accept them as inferior. And the good breeding stock among the females will reject them as possible partners. And the sixth is the creepiest of all, and I think it's partly what Tragedy and Hope is about. It's a fancy Roman name, the propaedeutic function. Because as early as Roman big-time thinkers, it was understood that to continue a social form required some people being trained that they were the custodians of this. So some small fraction of the kids are being ready to take over the project. That's the guy in the honor lecture, and it will not surprise you that his ancestors include the major general at the Siege of Lucknow in India, famous for tying the mutineers on the muzzles of the cannons and blowing them apart, or somebody who was forced to flee New York City, a churchman, because at the beginning of the American Revolution, because he wrote a refutation of Thomas Paine's Common Sense. They were going to tar and feather him. He fled and was rewarded by the British by making him the Bishop of Nova Scotia. Those are Ingalls' ancestors. So Al Ingalls is certainly, when I learned of this and wrote to Harvard asking for access to the Ingalls lecture, strike me dead, Lord, if I'm exaggerating at all, I was told, well, there is no Ingalls lecture, hasn't been for years, and we have no records. It was the same thing that happened when I discovered that Elwood P. Cubberley, the most influential schoolman of the 20th century and the bionomics genius, had been the elementary school editor of Houghton Mifflin. And I wrote Houghton Mifflin, is there any records? And they said, we have no record of anyone named Elwood P. Cubberley. Now Harvard's telling me there's no Ingalls lecture. A week passed, and I got a call from Harvard, from some obscure office at Harvard, saying, what is your interest in the Ingalls lecture? I knew that I was on thin ice. And I said, James Conant referred me in his books to the man the Ingalls lecture is named after, and I was wondering if I could get some background on this fellow and a list of the lectures. And in due time, I got a list of the lectures and instructions how to access the texts, but not easily. You know, enough hoops that someone who has to mow the lawn and burp the baby, wouldn't jump through those hoops. I was able to prove Harper's wouldn't publish when they did the cover essay I wrote, which Lou Latham named Against School, probably after Jeremiah's Against. But I had called The Artificial Extension of Childhood, because I think that's the key mechanism at work here.
Welcome back to Peace Revolution, episode 45. Minutes 30 through 45 of the Ultimate History Lesson. He began by referring to this guy, Wilhelm Wundt, who should be a familiar character in this play, this saga of education, if you will, if you've been listening through the first 4 hours. Wundt has a ligature to this guy named William James, and then John recites this very useful quote relating to the nature of habit, and it's the enormous flywheel that allows them to control people, and that the difference between the elite managerial ruling class and we, the masses, is that they're not only organized, but they have patterns and habits of repetitive organization with consistency. They're using methods and methodologies and tools, and we who have gone through the public school system have been denied these useful tools. And he's saying, hey, look, wake up. You've been conditioned to see it that way, but if you look around, it's all over the place, and you can easily learn your way out of this, because each and every one of us has an enormous potential, which, if we didn't, they wouldn't spend so much time and money indoctrinating each and every one of us through 15,000 hours of public schooling. So, John moves on to talk about this guy, Alexander Inglis, and he mentions a notorious character by now, James Bryant Conant. Who is this fella? A poison gas specialist during World War II, working on nuclear bombs, and then all of a sudden he has education experience, and he's writing all these books on education, and he's a president of Harvard University. I think in episode 44, Jan mentions him in the same paragraph out of the compromised campus, how the intelligence communities infiltrated the campuses, written by Sigmund Diamond and published by Oxford University. If I recall correctly, in that paragraph was James Bryan Conant, along with R. Gordon Wasson. But that's for your extra study after this episode. Moving on into the how learning isn't the reason that we're in school. What is the reason? Well, he gets into Alexander Inglis and the principles of secondary education, going through these six different functions of public schooling, which really haven't changed over the last century. In a recent interview on the Corbett Report, when I was discussing this with James, he noticed that as a school teacher in Japan, they teach these exact same six steps. And then I let him know that actually, if you listen on in this hour, you'll hear Gatto talk about how the Prussian education system and the Prussian constitution was imported to Japan, and that's why the Japanese education system, like many other education systems around the world, is run off the Prussian model, because it's a very efficient and effective way to control and manipulate people and bring about the will and goal of the state. That's why John's been invited to China six times to speak, because the Chinese have imported the Prussian education system and they said, hey, look, it works really well at controlling people, but we want them to be more creative as if they were free, but we can't let them be free because then they won't be as productive. And when we run our economies around ideas like this, it's a downward spiral that we are just now beginning to notice, but it's not too late. We have mechanisms of communication and we have abilities to get together and around common needs and ideas resolve our own problems and not wait or depend on others who might exist as governments or big foundations or corporations to do the solving for us, as they actually are the ones creating the problems that we're trying to solve. And when people ask, what is the solution? You should say back to them, what, you don't know? Because if you understood the problem, the solution would be evident.
It's hard to follow that up because it's a poignant thing to say, right? The thing about the solution is everyone's looking for it externally, but you have to fill yourself up with solution first before you can share any solution with anyone. It's like having love. If you don't love yourself, you can't. So it's hard to love anyone else, kind of a thing. So identifying the problem, the correct problem, the root cause problem, which is kind of the point of this whole podcast series, to realize that we don't have informed consent. The problem is our choices don't reflect our reality because our reality is masked. And all these different mechanisms, we're trying to identify each of them in detail so people can build an inoculation to them. But all of these mechanisms work in all these different angles to try and render us into this unreality that is, as Coolio would say, a gangster's paradise or a bankster's paradise.
And the habitual behavior that they are instilling is disempowering and self-defeating in the sense that it's mostly amusements, sports, and conspicuous consumption, etc. You've got compulsory schooling, you've got television, you've got divide and conquer competitions, etc. These are all forms of habitual behavior that, even though they're disempowering, because they've become habits, no one is questioning them. They're just sort of going along, and that's why these other things will not be uncovered, because there's too many disempowering habitual behaviors taking up much of their time.
Well, what you're saying is that they have too many amusements. And those are times during which you don't actively think. That's what makes them amusing, because to muse means to think, to contemplate, to consider that which has not yet happened, because life depends, as a human being, on our effective ability to plan ahead for survival.
So this adjustive function isn't just instilling fixed habits of reaction to authority, but it's instilling fixed habits of reaction to everything, to government, to politicians, to healthcare, medicine, et cetera, religion.
And that's why one of the key mechanisms they control is media. And, you know, habit then is completely connected then with the artificial extension of childhood. right? I mean, once they instill these behaviors, because they found out it's so much easier to instill behaviors, especially when you're a child, that it ends up you act as though you're a child the rest of your life. And that's what Gatto continually mentions throughout this interview session, is that, you know, the key mechanism to what they've done to us through this mental conditioning, through the media, through all these amusements.
The artificial extension of childhood, he calls it.
Exactly.
Who created the term adolescence?
Who indeed?
G. Stanley Hall.
Who was a student of Wilhelm Wundt, one of the first PhDs in psychology to come back to the United States. And from there, you can follow, as Anthony Sutton points out, again, in America's Secret Establishment, Introduction to Skull and Bones, Chapter 8, How the Order Controls Education. He shows three particular people from Yale, from Skull and Bones Secret Society, called the Yale Troika. That's the nomenclature for Andrew Dixon White, Timothy Dwight, and Daniel Coit Gilman. And these three characters also were trained not only in Wundtian psychology, but were colleagues and students of G. Stanley Hall, and G. Stanley Hall then went to, Kevin, correct me if I'm wrong, Johns Hopkins University?
Became the president of Johns Hopkins University after a stint in California.
Andrew Dixon White went on to become president of Cornell University, as you cited earlier. So when you follow the ideas of Prussian education, Prussian psychology, how to control and manipulate people to take them over and to remove their volition and free will, how to make them sacrifice themselves for the state, which, if you remember back in 1806 at the Battle of Jena, that was the original problem that created the Prussian institution and Prussian education and Prussian militarism that we've inherited in America in the first place. So when you follow it full circle, there is this philosophy which is irrational that has been installed in each and every one of us through the public school system, but there is a way to learn your way out, and it starts with taking a look around at, well, what is everyone doing? If they're amusing themselves, that is proof of an artificial extension of childhood. People who, as adults, they spend a lot of their time playing games. Well, have you planned for your survival yet? Planning for your survival isn't just buying some storable food and getting some kerosene or what have you to keep yourself warm. It's about learning your way outside of the managerial box that has been put in front of us. And the manager is not spending their time learning more. They're spending their time managing us. There is an expeditious way which we can skip ahead of the curve and get ahead of this, but it takes a little bit more resources than we've put into it in the past. And I think we all have to make changes in our habits and start to use that enormous flywheel of creativity to our own balance and to our own equilibrium. So going back to Alexander Ingalls and the principles of secondary education, naming the Harvard lecture in education after Ingalls, that must be pretty substantial work that he laid down. And after 2 years, John's able to get his hands on a copy of The Principles of Secondary Education, and we have several copies of it here as well. Let me read off these habits again. Number one, fixed habits. That means they want them all to react the same way. Number two, the integrative function. That means they're all as alike as possible, as interchangeable parts. So if you present information to a crowd of people, they're all likely, if it causes cognitive dissonance, to have a similar emotional reaction and bring up irrational points, because that's why they're having an emotional reaction. They're not using observation, logic, and compassionate communication. Number three, the directive function. The social role is defined usually by the teacher, and their future starts to be more and more limited based on the information, access, accreditation that they're being provided through a public school system. Number four, the differentiating function. This is to help keep them separated and to keep people – this is preparing them for number five, which is the selective function, breeding qualities. But the differentiating function, number four, keeping them separated in their different social castes, social strata, giving them labels, names, you know, sort of remarks in class to let others know that these aren't suitable people to be breeding with. The selective function is definitely about the breeding qualities. As John says, this is one of the creepiest steps that teachers are undertaking unwittingly, but it's part of the system that they've all inherited and just assumed it was all about educating. And as John says, volition is removed in a schooling situation, so that makes education not something of education. It's not learning. It's now conditioning or being modeled in somebody else's desired image. Six, the last is the propaedeutic function, which is preparing some of these people to be the future managers, the future ranchers on this plantation. And without giving this same information and giving people equal access to all these layers of information, it really sets up a solidified production, a mass production line of the class system that has been inherited
re-inherited from Britain during the years after 1812, especially after the Civil War toward the end of the 19th century.
And to give a little bit of background on Elwood P. Coverley, who was Alexander Inglis's pupil, he was the bionomics genius, as Gatto mentions. The goal of bionomics was to guide evolution along Galtonian principles through education.
Well, before you can even continue, the schooling that Inglis describes is manage plus select plus adjust. And now you're bringing up this new word, bionomics, which, if I remember correctly, means the law of life. They're actually creating new laws to control, to patent, to manipulate, to evolve life in their selected image, as their little philosophy allows them to violate the volition of every individual on the planet, something that they like to call justified sinning. Please continue.
I have Coverley of Stanford by Sears and Henderson of the Stanford Press. There is yet to be added to this busy life one other line of work which does much to reveal the insight and vision of the man and to throw light upon how he built his department. In 1911, while lecturing at Harvard, he developed, with Houghton Mifflin Company and Alexander Inglis, the idea of a series of textbooks on education. The first volume of the series, since known throughout the English-speaking world as the Riverside Textbooks in Education, appeared from his own pen in 1914. The series, not the first ever undertaken by an American publisher, quickly gained recognition, and in the history of the textbook making in the field of education, it will now hold a position of prominence not only for the period covered for many years to come, not for the lack of books published otherwise through these years, but for the nature and scope of the series and the special needs that it met. At its beginning, there was a dearth of teaching material, although there was much scholarly activity in the field of a growing demand for textbooks that were abreast of the recent scientific works in the fields of psychology, biology, sociology, government, statistics, tests and measurements, school survey methods, child hygiene, and vocational and educational guidance. Works in these fields was reaching a point where textbook presentation of findings was greatly needed if a real advance was to be expected in preparing young people to undertake scientific study in these newly opened areas. We shall be further concerned later with the extensive editorial work involved in developing this series. There is no way of knowing how many manuscripts Coverley read and rejected, but the reading and editing of such a series of books looks almost like a full-time task in itself. This work is noted here for the special part it played in building Stanford's School of Education. Its editor alone wrote 10 of the 106 books. 15 others bore the names of the colleagues. A number of the others bore the names of former students of the school. With but few exceptions, the list included the leading younger scholars in the field of those years. That these books were widely influential is evidenced in the account of their sales. By Houghton Mifflin's records, Coverley's 10 books of the series sold to the number of 341,000 copies, and figures for the entire series amounted to approximately 3,070,000 copies. The new teaching material made available by this series is of wide range, covering developments in the many areas that were opened up through the period of years. One only has to set its titles beside those of the earlier and very noteworthy series, the International Education Series, to see the progress that has been made. When the dates of these various types of work are checked on the calendar, along with the dates of publication of Coverley's many articles, monographs, and books with their revisions, and these in the teaching of his own or other universities, one must regard him as having lived a very busy life. It was by this kind of drive that these types of works were carried on in the task of building a school of education to Stanford. My point in this is that Coverley was in a very influential position at Stanford, where his textbooks and his methodologies and his bionomics experience was being solidified and standardized across the country. These books became widely popular, and school boards built their very structures around them.
What I'm noticing is that Leland Stanford, who not only has a prestigious university named after him, Leland Stanford, interestingly enough, that's where the first Mosem pictures come from. It was Leland Stanford photograph, having the photographs of the horse that proved that the horse, all four hoofs leave the ground at the same time. And that's the first Mosem picture, which is today's biggest amusement. At the same time, Leland Stanford is employing Elwood P. Coverley. And as Gatto says, this is a guy who, when they went to fact check his article, Houghton Mifflin and the people who had printed Coverley's work, Macmillan Publishing, etc., all denied that he existed. And here in my hand, I hold a 1925 copyright, An Introduction to the Study of Education by Elwood P. Coverley, Riverside Textbooks in Education, Houghton Mifflin and Company, Cambridge, Massachusetts. So this is coming from the same town as Harvard, and yet people deny this exists, John. Why are they hiding these nuggets of history? Why are they telling them at Harvard that there's no Inglis lecture?
why does he get suspicious phone calls and people say funny things to him and they say, we'll let you see this stuff, but you have to jump through a bunch of hoops, kind of to discourage anyone from accessing this information. Might there be useful information about the design of our public school system in these books, which they occult or hide, but they're very useful? Harvard's honor lecture, the Ingalls lecture, there's all sorts of, you know, minutia. If you go digging beyond where they say, no, don't go here, and go and look for yourself, you can find all these little things. We have copies of the Principles of Secondary Education in front of us. It didn't take us 2 years to find it. That's the difference between when John was going out and trying to verify his own facts and get his logical anchor to reality by examining what is there to observe, what artifacts are there, what are the primary sources, how can we start to catalog these things. It took him a lot longer and a lot more trouble to get his hands on these artifacts than it could for you today, as we have proven, you know, over and over again. You can find PDFs, you can find them on archive.org, you can search text on the Library of Congress, you can go to your local library, you can buy books used. I'm not talking about funding Amazon or buying recently published books or paying high prices. I'm talking about putting the resources that you have around you and that the abilities and observations and curiosity that you have to logical, constructive work, figuring out what is going on, figuring out how to effectively plan for your future, and figuring out how to get more satisfaction out of each and every choice that you are now making, because it's an informed decision that is only according to your consent. Because that's how government works, only when you consent. And when you don't consent and they continue going, that's just an individual breaking the law, because their uniform or their costume or their badge or what have you is no longer something you need to capitulate to if you don't consent. And if you're informed, sooner or later, it'll be to your benefit. And with that, we'll go to the last 15 minutes of Hour 5 of the Ultimate History Lesson. We'll be right back.
So they wouldn't print the information about Coverley because Hart Mifflin denied it. It was only months afterward that I looked through my extensive library of incredibly dull books about schooling and opened in the facing page, said Elwood Coverley, editor-in-chief, elementary school, publishing arm of Hart Mifflin. By the way, the secondary editor-in-chief was Alexander Ingalls. So you see how this cousinage, the incest, works.
If Martin Luther's idea was to cut out the middleman and teachers read books, why can't students just read books instead of going to the middleman for their information?
Well, the more highly placed the schooling is, the more likely it is that they do that. They go to primary documents. They understand how suspicious all secondary documents are. Not that they aren't useful, but they give the writer or the editorial staff the ability to shift the information. That's why in the reprints of Quigley's Tragedy and Hope, we really need some of you out there to sit with the original and sit with the reprint and make sure the key things aren't elided on perfectly reasonable grounds that, you know, we want to shrink this down from 1,300 pages to 1,000 or whatever. Oh, it was an oversight.
We have 8 minutes, nine minutes left. I have two questions, and then we can do an informal book signing and get you out of here. What time?
Yeah, well, you should want to know what happens to an ordinary class of 13-year-olds when they get a smattering of that. I mean, as much as they can absorb in a short time. Well, many of you will have seen Strawberry Fields, the monument to the Beatles in Central Park. I don't want to pat myself on the back because I didn't much care for the Beatles and I hate using Parkland for it. But I was approached by three girls, two of them here, bitterly complaining that the community planning board had denied Yoko Ono's petition to build Strawberry Fields. And they were furious that this had been done. And I said, well, you don't have to accept their decision. They're the lowest part of the pecking order. First, according to protocol, you have to take your case to them. So we'll book you an appointment, and you lay down the reasons you want to take 3 acres of Central Park and give it to this group who could only play 3 musical chords. But I told them, whatever you want to do, including building a pistol, I'll show you how you can learn how to do that. I won't censor. So it had been voted down 45-8 by the Community Planning Board, and the Community Planning Board unanimously rejected their appeal. I said, now you want to look who has to sign off on their decision. This is not a group of local big shots. This is the Landmarks Preservation Commission. You don't get on that unless your ancestors come over on the Mayflower or you have $10 billion. I said, this is the elite of the elite. And now what you want to do is research. The names are publicly accessible. 23 of them, and I'll bet 4 or 5 of them would already be in favor of this thing. All you need is 12 of them to reject this for it to happen. So you find out who these people are and get as much biographical information. You know, IT has made this on these people, and you will find the buttons to play them like a noble organ. You know, you can find out what causes they became noteworthy for, et cetera, et cetera. And now what you're going to do, because there's 12,000 kids in this school district, is I'm going to free you from school for a month, and you're going to split up. You go from school to school, find troublemakers, and get petitions. Because what we need, because your letterhead will say committee of 5,000. We need 5,000 signatures on a petition. And you're going to write an individual letter writing campaign to each of the 23 members of the Community Planning Board asking them to please immortalize this group. Well, I get a phone call in the front office from someone out of class. I was 6 weeks later. And the voice on the phone says, hello, this is Yoko Ono. You know, and I thought it was one of my cockamamie friends. I said, you know, this is George Washington, Yoko. What's on your mind? Fortunately, she didn't take umbrage. Maybe didn't even hear me saying it. She said, the decision has been reversed. I want to hold a party at the Dakota for these girls. Could they be released from school? Well, I don't know, Yoko. I mean, I got a missile. So, that's one. Look at this one. Here's a 12-year-old C student from... he lived in Harlem. He was a C student, but he's a polite young fellow. He was going nowhere there, and he had the effrontery to go to a pizza parlor in all white Upper West Side in 1980. And the owner of the parlor, a 6'6" crazy Greek who happened to be a friend of mine, took his pizza, took his soda, threw them away. The charge was he had taken 2 straws. You only allow 1 straw, right? So he comes over ranting about racial prejudice. I said it was the wrong thing to do, and I'm going to show you how to deal with it. But I don't think it was racial prejudice. His clientele at lunch comes from the collegiate school. They wear blue blazers, gold buttons. John F. Kennedy's kid went there. They leave big tips for his staff. And he knows the public school kids, black or white, go in there for lunch. He's going to lose that blue ribbon trade. Nevertheless, you're going to give him a chance to back down. This is an absolutely massive, insane Greek who believes violence is the solution to all problems. Once Jerry Mulligan, the famous jazz saxophonist, bounced a $10 check, he had it blown up to billboard size and mounted outside the restaurant. Okay. So I said, you go to the phone and I'll listen. And you say, I'm the guy whose pizza you took, but I'm willing to let bygones be bygones if I could. Nick hangs up on him. I said, I'm going to give you what in law is called an affidavit that you attempted to solve this problem peaceably. Now, I said, you want to go over there in person tomorrow, and I'll provide a long-distance witness, and you want to say, look, it's just a slice of pizza. Give me my slice of pizza back. But Nick had the bid between out the kid goes. And now I said, you're going to call him one more time with a different teacher as a witness. Then you're going to write him a letter, certified, return receipt requested, 65 cents in those days. And now you have four pieces of evidence to provide to the court. And then you're going to sue his ass in small claims court. Only cost like $3 in those days. But it was 17 miles from the school. Kids can't sue. I said, anyone with $3 can sue. That doesn't mean you're going to win. But the way the referee in small claims court decides, since it's one person's, is who has evidence that they acted reasonably. And you will have four pieces of evidence, and this guy will be steam coming out of his ear. Well, he was awarded triple damages. How about that? Mm-hmm. Now, what do you suppose the small claims court referee said when he got home that night to his friend? You're not going to believe what I just adjudicated. So beginning about 4 days later, we get a call from the Brooklyn College Law School. Could he come over and lecture? Of course, he said no. And I said, listen, I'll ruin you if you don't. We'll work it out. Then Columbia Law School called. Then we got daily calls from judges to take him out to lunch, because isn't this a symbol that the system... Really? Okay. He's the only kid in 30 years of teaching that took my advice not to waste your time in high school. I said, any number of very good colleges will take you in at the end of your sophomore year if you provide the documentation. You're ready. He went to Duke, full tuition scholarship. Then Duke University Law School, and by the way, these two events, Strawberry Fields and Pizza Palace Suit, are from the same term in a junior high school. Just a few more of these things. Here's a PhD from UCal. Here's a 13-year-old girl who came to me complaining that her mother was a liar, said she could go to Paris alone that summer if she could raise the money. She said, I just checked, and nobody. I mean, she was a single-parent household. Mother was a secretary. She said, nobody. I said, well, you can't do it on a job, but there's not very much money if you have a little business. And she said, 13-year-old kids can't have businesses. I said, if you have something people want, they don't care how old you are. I mean, Sean Fanning almost ruined the music business with Napster. He was 17. So she takes a week out of school, figures out a really interesting exotic business that you can read my book and find out what it was, and raises enough money in a short time by cutting school for six consecutive weeks that she could afford to pay her mother's way to Paris. She came and said, I've got much more money than I need. I said, why don't you take your mother to Paris? She might appreciate it. On the basis of that, she went to what I believe is the finest college in the United States, Hampshire College, where you write your own curriculum and then you negotiate with the faculty. My granddaughter goes there, will be graduating next year. Hello, Christina. That's all I'll say. So,
what phrase in Icelandic means writing of God?
Yes. Well, it's a, her real name was, it's carried popularly as Gudrun, but she wasn't satisfied, so she went to court and changed it to Christina. So, hey, you know, what are you going to do?
If you could say something that would echo through time and each and every person from now until the end of humanity would hear it.
Yeah. Sensible children do not wish to be incomplete human beings. And so when you impose a stage theory of human development upon them, you affect or tormenting them, you're limiting their opportunities. The whole world for all history knew that childhood is over about the age of 7, and if it persists beyond the age of 12, you've got some hopeless human being on your mind. Don't be your kid's enemy, because they're not a kid. That's a fellow human being, male or female. Be their partner and enlarge the opportunities. No homework, please.
What does a college education really get you in the 21st century?
I think it's consistently given less and less. It essentially was the last hoop to jump through, but it never delivered much to most of the people who jumped through that hoop. It is possible, if you understand that an education is something you have to take, to use the resources that are assembled there and actually stitch together an education for yourself and get some value. But most people, of course, follow a prescribed plan which has been put together by a committee somewhere, and in fact doesn't do much for most people. I went to Cornell, Columbia, and Reed College, and I can guarantee from Cornell and Columbia, I remember nothing except the babes, the alcohol, hangovers, etc. From Reed, I got a little bit out of a Plato seminar that I do remember, basically arguing with the professor who encouraged that. You know, it doesn't give you a bang for your buck unless you commit. Which, who does? Isn't it supposed to produce a certificate that certifies you as eligible? The funny thing is that IT has accidentally exploded a lot of that, because so many people, I remember my daughter graduated from MIT, and she used to bitterly complain that her classmates would vanish for months at a time doing jobs for various companies, then come back as if nothing had happened and nobody punished them. you know, sorry to say that we were so slow picking up on, you judge people by performance, not by credentials. And real people, you'd be insane to hire on the basis of credentials, because the skew between memory and application is so large that eventually you're top-heavy with people who don't know how to do anything much.
I'm going to ask this last question. I'm going to go burn your DVD. Is that way you're not late? And so just answer to Jitu and Tony and Kevin. What is the value of persistence as juxtaposed to the learning process?
About 10 years ago, I set up, I helped to set up a foundation that at Edison High School in New Jersey awards $10,000 a year to the most persistent student in the class. And persistence in the face of adversity is the final test. If you can stick to something, nothing is difficult to learn. I mean, nothing at all. But the natural selection process, operating on a low boredom quotient, on personal disrespect, I can't do that, and many other things, eliminates almost everyone except the persistent. Those are the ones who demonstrate merit. Now, obviously, a lot of the control mechanism is inherited or appointed, but the parts that aren't go to the persistent. And that includes the arts and the sciences as well as politics. I mean, who could imagine, for example, that an obviously inferior human being, I'm not speaking politically here, like George W. Bush, could pass through all the screens on the way up and then be elected not once but twice by the American population. He flunked his pilot's course, 25 out of 100, and now he's supposed to be given a jet to fly in combat. But of course he pulled strings, he didn't do that. And clearly he was an imbecile. He looked like an imbecile, he talked like an imbecile, and you cannot believe that any decisions attributed to him were actually made by him. No one would be crazy enough to put him in charge and say, you mind the store and I'll go off. So, but he was persistent, and he did reject the negative assessments that occurred all through his life. What a rock is about, in my opinion, is showing Daddy that the people who embarrassed Daddy got their comeuppance. And who the hell cares that the carnage is? He's one of the great mass murderers in history. But Daddy's reputation was saved from disgrace.
What do you feel the role of UNESCO has been in the manipulation of the educational
curriculum? Well, I'm bothered a little bit by the general mass of conspiracy literature attributes powers to the United Nations, which it simply doesn't have. That doesn't mean that it isn't filled with villainous intentions. I mean that it never succeeded in becoming, people say it's a respectable institution, but they don't no one says, what does the UN say about, no one says that, you know, and they've almost given up trying. I mean, there's now a minority opinion that it's not worth spending the money to have it in the United States. You know, because it's as much anti-American as it carries out our subtler designs.
I've noticed that UNESCO focuses a lot of their workings on the educational
network
of nations, and you go to the
website. But you and I would too.
Pestalozzi and Herbart and Wundt are all listed.
Yeah, of course. Well, wouldn't anyone say it's easier to deal with unformed minds with no experience? Wean them away. It's in an engineering sense what you would expect to happen, and so we wouldn't be surprised that that's what does happen.
Who was Johann Pestalozzi, and what were some of his few ideas?
The most intriguing thing about the followers of Pestalozzi are that they never count the fact that every single one of his projects quickly failed. Every single one of them. What he had that was intriguing to the Prussian hierarchy and really the global hierarchy was that his method of kindness, and it may have been sincere, his method of kindness was a new weapon in the arsenal of, instead of whipping the poor, threatening them, menacing them, tormenting them, you killed them with kindness. The written principles of the Fabians are Pestalozzian, by extending this blanket of kindness to people. It's still effective in that, a big fraction of the American population expects charity and sees it as a blessing. Now, it's not hard to see why on this day or that day it could be a blessing, but overall, that you get weaker and weaker, like your arm gets weaker if it doesn't lift stuff above your head. I mean, it's such a fundamental principle of human physics, including mental physics, that to pull the wool over so many people's eyes.
I got you this. It's got all the transcripts from your Gnostic media interviews, Jan's definition of liberal, and some Gordon Wasson
information
for it. You also talked about the cruise to open up
excellent.
Asia. And this is
excellent.
This is Taft's on the... It's Roosevelt's daughter. Roosevelt's president. Taft goes with her, and they open up... They go back to Japan after... who is the admiral that you mentioned that went over there?
Not Dewey.
But you know what I'm saying? They had already gone over there, and this was the second one, and then this sets up the whole World War II, World War I, the whole scenario, the opium smuggling, it's all in there. And this guy wrote Flags of Our Fathers and Flyboys.
Oh, yes.
James Bradley.
Yes.
And so I thought you might.
Thank you. I will.
You'll enjoy it. You did an outstanding job.
Hey, this has been a lovely course in how complicated it is, to make
to get the word out. Have you seen this book? No. It's called The Perfectibilist. It's by Terry Mollinson.
No.
That was the name of the Illuminati before it was known as the Illuminati. It was the Perfectibilists, and they were a private club. And this means... Per me, caci vident means through me, the blind become sighted. So their top secret is the trivium and learning, but they use it out of order, so they don't establish what exists first. They assert logic without.
No.
If you look in the back, it has a full glossary of individuals.
All members.
He's cataloged. Now, this is my copy, but I want you to take it, and I can get another one.
Oh,
and then you can
God bless.
Chris Milligan.
And God bless.
This here is the reference of Carl Wundt. And it goes into some of his colleagues, and you'll have a lot of references to your own material.
Thank you all, and certainly...
Now you got a heavy bag to carry.
Now I got a heavy bag to carry.
I'll take it for you. Get it. Let me get your mic off, yeah?
Yes.
And...
Welcome back to Peace Revolution, episode 45. That was the last 15 minutes of the fifth hour of the Ultimate History Lesson. And finally, we're getting to the point where he's giving a couple examples of how you can provide our youth. You know, how are we going to solve these problems if we don't start figuring out what's going on right now and making certain that it doesn't proliferate in the future? Well, the first thing we can do is teach children how to solve their own problems. This is an invaluable skill that John gives you a couple examples of students who came to him and said, hey, look, there's this thing I'd like to achieve or this problem I have. And he teaches them, as soon as you can get past your emotional reaction and gain your balance and think responsibly and reasonably using a method, he's giving them constructive ways to meet and surmount physical and mental obstacles. And that is a key not only to learning and survival, but to learning how to thrive in this crazy system that seems to be built to be broken on purpose because it benefits the few at the expense of the many.
And there's this recurring theme of kids who have gotten to him in middle school and have this idea that when they have a problem, they can't do anything about it. For example, the little boy who says, kids can't sue, or the little girl who says, kids can't own a business, etc.
Well, and in the case of the kid that can't sue, it's because it's 17 miles away. The court is a long way away. And John says, hey, look, for a couple of pennies, which is well within your grasp, there are effective means of battling these problems. You don't have to give up. You can use the U.S. Postal Service and pay a couple cents and certify it, and it gets this and this done. And John just clues them in on a couple things that I really wasn't aware that you could have, like, a remote witness. And, you know, I only became aware of affidavits and the legal process when I was almost 30. Just think if we had all been instilled with this is just how things work, and if we had been instilled with the idea that we as human beings have natural predators, and here's all the history that you can spend 30 years learning, but just take it on the experience that we have to lock our cars and close our windows and lock our houses and do these different things that we all have to do because of what goes on, just recognize that not everybody is cool with people who just labor and have property. Some other people don't want to labor, and they want to take your property, and that's how they make their living.
Well, it seems like it's about overcoming resistance, right, with these children, and the fact that the school system is there to break that willingness, that curiosity to question and, you know, come to their own conclusion to try to figure things out for
and
themselves.
And to want to understand why.
They have to first go to Gatto, you know, appeal to an authority in this case. And Gatto's like, well, okay, obviously at this point he understands the problems, the underlying mechanisms behind this system. So he says, well, here, just use a method, a simple method to show. In each situation the method's a bit different, but it still applies to understanding how these systems work, applying logic, connecting the dots, and employing effective, compassionate communication. All of this really has to go back to, you know, a lot of it to compassionate communication and making sure they present themselves in such a manner that not only can they observe the key figures to make a change, right, to observe the key gatekeepers of knowledge to make sure something can be disseminated. And
well, the idea is to communicate the observations and the needs and not to make judgments, because it's the judgments that cause all the conflict. And so if we each just recognize observations and our needs, we're all on the same page.
Right.
We can talk about the UNSAID conference and, like, what does this all roll up to today? The UNSAID conference is United Nations, education, environment, all this different stuff, all rolled into one. The eugenics, the control of populations, the world order.
The name of the game is getting us submitted so that the violation of volition feels like nothing. Like it's the most regular thing in the world. And, you know, getting us to not only be efficient slaves, but to appreciate and love our slavery and worship the slave masters and try and emulate them to the degree, right? That's what popular culture seems to reflect. So the methodology to accomplish that is to extend our adolescence, to keep us in a helpless state of mind where we're deferring our own power, and then to muddy the waters by using divide and conquer strategies, right? All these Hegelian dialectics to create compartmentalized dichotomies, essentially. All these little mini divide and conquer strategies that allow people's time to be wasted, essentially. And focusing on all these external things it's almost a form of amusement, but it feels like thinking, but you're thinking within a box. and, you know, the problems exist outside that box. So if we're going to re-realize our free will, which is our true freedom, and not have it be co-opted by these external sources, we need that intellectual self-defense, that virus scanner called the Trivium, and understanding this methodology with which to discern reality in a way that's going to leave us able to fend off the predators. We may be soft and easily malleable, but we also have this resilience and this ability to learn our way out of situations. That's whether it comes from evolution or genetic tinkering or whatever the source of that power is, as long as we realize it's not about survival of the fittest or the most competitive, although friendly competition is great, it's about cooperation and building towards this realization that as long as we remain apathetic, then we're just going to be guided like a runaway train or like lemmings off a hill. And it all starts with going into yourself, finding that dialectic, if you don't already have it, and actively engaging yourself to reappraise your own operating system. You have to go into yourself and say, double check everything that you believe at this moment. And it's called a reality check. And if you find that anything's out of place, that you've got contradictions, then you need to investigate that. And the whole purpose of this is to turn what may be quicksand that you're treading into a solid foundation of concrete ideas that are stable, that you can rest other ideas upon. And then once you've got that understanding, then you can go and share it with other people. And that's going to not only empower them, but it's going to re-empower you, because there's those strength in those numbers. And so in that way, instead of the uneducated mob that can be constantly have their energy suckled upon by the 0.001%, we can become batteries that empower each other, or more than batteries, but we can become power plants that help empower each other. There you go.
And I think for parents that have children, something that might be very helpful is that in a culture that is so conditioned to us, you know, subscribe their attention or their own thoughts to authorities, you know, the important thing is for parents out there to make sure they act as a mentor, as a guide, to make sure when the child is confronted with that problem, which obviously is going to come up quite often through just their peer groups, their interactions with coworkers, their interactions with just the classmates, teachers, any type of function, is just to help them, guide them along, because that's really what Gatto did here. Gatto just, when they had that resistance, they went to him because they trusted him already, because he already showed them so much, how much potential they actually have. And he just showed them that, in fact, that you don't have to be scared here. There's a method to help go through these steps, not necessarily the Trivium in this case, but still a method to observe, understand, and compassionately communicate and make effective change, I mean, with these children. And they, in fact, did.
So the question is there any escape? Is there any place we can go on Earth? Is any community here in America so rich that this does not pertain to them? Is there any type of hope for everybody? Is there?
Ask not what you can do.
With eyes. All right. Now I'm going to have to do the whole thing over. Okay.
No.
So the question is there any escape? Does this affect everyone? Is there any community in America that is so rich that they are impervious to the cause and effect of this situation? And the question might be, what can we do about it? I think we've tried to show you what we can do about it. When we found out about it, this is what we did about it. We invited John, we raised the funds, we did the research, we went through, we produced it, then we studied it. We added the footnotes, we did the research, we're bringing it all to you and serving it up on a silver platter. And it's almost amusing if you didn't have to think about everything. But we give you the tools and the resources and the next steps, not only the notes and references, but the ultimatehistorylesson.com, which I swear, real-time listeners, is almost done. We also have just burned in the last 24 hours the first 4-disc set of the DVDs, and I have a bunch of cases printed out here. So we are actually pretty excited to get to this point, to put a cap on not only these Peace Revolution roundtables on this specific topic of the Ultimate History Lesson, but also to bring this project to the public that is not aware
of the finer workings of our education system, our government, our economy, and everything that affects our ability to survive. And with that, we're going to bring episode 45 to a close.
I think we've provided the audience a significant set of tools and significant amount of information to further their learning, and it's really up to the audience now to go from here and to investigate and pull it together further than we already have.
Well, which podcast was it, 49, 50, and 51, Jan, of your Gnostic Media podcast that introduced?
Yes, indeed. It's with Gino Denning on my site, and they can go to the Trivium Study link on the left side of the website and start from the bottom and work your way up and really just go through everything that's on that page, as well as TriviumEducation.com.
Paul, did you have any closing comments?
No, I'm pretty good with my involvement thus far, but I appreciate that we took the time to do these all and to do them right and to really get this variety of opinions and elucidate all these pieces of ultimate history, I guess. You could call it forensic history, but I think it's a gift for people that you guys were able to connect with John and to have him come down in the flesh and connect with you guys on a real level. You can see that he's active and engaged and enjoyed being interviewed. And I think if he looks back upon everything that he's done in terms of sharing his knowledge, that, yeah, this is probably one of the most comprehensive looks at both his life and what he's accrued. And so it's kind of a legacy. And so I just feel honored to be a part of the group, getting to analyze and discuss both the history and the ramifications and ultimately the solutions to what's going on with both education and the application of power by the elite. So hopefully this helps people learn their way out of whatever situation they're in, and then to give them the tools to go on and not only solve their problems, but to create new opportunities and find a greater degree of satisfaction in life. So thanks for letting me be a part of it.
Discovering the solutions has everything to do with understanding the problems. Do you have any closing thoughts, Kev?
Yeah, I just would like to say thank you to everybody for the great discussions over the past weeks of the 5 hours and analysis. And a special thank you to John Taylor Gatto for coming down and doing the interview here in Connecticut, and for Richard and Lisa for hosting us. And this is something that I feel will be present in history 100 years from now. There will be people YouTubing or whatever is available at that time and looking back at this. And hopefully by the time people are looking at this in the future,
some sense of autonomy.
Right. Right. Well, yeah,
Those who don't get it real time, we have hope in the future that this artifact will figure its way out there. We don't need to cut it, man.
I want to cut that for sure, please.
Now we're not cutting it.
Oh, come on. Yeah.
Now it's funny.
No, it's not funny at all. Well, my point in that was I've been extremely grateful. This experience has been something that I'll never forget. It has so many ramifications in our daily lives, and to be a part of something that is so close to the cutting edge of getting this material out to people and articulated in a way that it's never been done before, and in scratching the insecurities and scratching the commercialism and really getting to the heart of these issues and putting them into perspective on how they relate to our lives on a daily basis. And many of our families have went through their whole lives without knowing the facts of the existence in which we live. You want to call that a meme, or you want to call it a negation of our ability to be free human beings. And I can't stand for not caring for that, and for people that want to ignore this information and not look at the primary sourcing and don't see past that cognitive dissonance, it's going to be really tough to have arguments against the facts. I mean, if you're not looking into the primary sources and you're not understanding the perspective that is being presented, how can you arm yourself with any kind of intellectual defense down the road? How are you going to survive in the future?
Any closing thoughts, Tony?
Yeah, honestly, I don't really have too much. It would be way too hard right now to sum up the experience I've had over the past 6 or 7 months. I don't even know.
It's been a long time.
So, I mean, right now it would be too hard to describe. But I hope, and I truly do believe, the audience will get a lot out of this, especially if this is an artifact for posterity that I know will live on and hopefully be useful. So,
well, I'd like to think that somewhere out there, John is listening to this right now, that he and his posterity will find that he used his time in a very interesting and useful and valuable way, not just to himself, but to people here and now and in the future. And so the question about what can we do about it beyond listening, what you're doing right now, is to check out the primary resources, because until you are understanding of all these points, it's not enough just to know about them. You need to actually understand what's going on, because I think that's what really kicks in the real drive of curiosity and motivation to get something done, because the coherent plan that is in action after these 5 hours that John has left us with is that there is a group of people who have a philosophy which designate them as chosen people of God, and that they are allowed to justifiably sin across generations and centuries. And that this justification rolls up today in so many things, not just our school system, but your economy and everything that has anything to do with being an American, paying taxes, having property, having the rights to go out and make your own business and produce a product and sell it. All these things that made America America, the self-reliance, all the things that made the foundation have been systematically dissolved away by a group of people who don't believe in nations and believe in an international goal. And they, over centuries, have progressed and organized and proliferated and profited from the mechanization of human beings and the profiteering and pilfering and plundering of everything that they know and love. They are dissolving the family, they're dissolving personal property rights, they're dissolving individual civil rights across the world, not just in our country. But if you look at what's going on at some of these Occupy Wall Street protests, if you're listening in real time, you see some of the injustice, the inhumanity that can be systematized, as Paul mentioned, with the Amtssprache observation, where people can be convinced that it's in their best interest to outsource their critical thinking skills and let someone else make decisions on their behalf. And that has everything to do with how Nazi Germany was formed. It has everything to do with Prussian education coming here and evolving in America to the point where we are so incoherent that we are not able to recognize our own inability to think critically. And so, in learning the lesson that there is something going on, that these predators are real, and that there is a tomorrow. We got to wake up tomorrow and, again, deal with the unknown and figure out what to do. This story is going to continue way beyond the end publication of this episode. So what we're all preparing for in listening and investing our times is preparing for life, to be out there and be effective and survive and thrive and protect our family and friends from predators. And so if there's anything that we've learned, it's that no matter how educated you are or how much of a genius you are or how good your connections are in life, that without persistence, nothing worthwhile is really going to get done.
You've now experienced the first step of the ultimate history lesson. We've done the hard work of organizing the facts, and now it's up to you to think, learn, communicate, and take action among yourselves. But we don't expect you to do this alone, and in fact, since this message applies to all of us, it's truly a circumstance which unites us and makes us indivisible, so that we might deliver freedom and justice, not just to ourselves, but to people around the world. If there is a point to all of this, it might be in realizing that the system isn't broken. It was built this way, on purpose. It serves those who created it, not those who are managed by it. As a result, our potential as human beings has been undermined. Our birthright has been stolen, and our adolescent period of life has been extended indefinitely. We have been numbed to these facts, which have been obscured further by the 15,000 hours of public schooling, which is mandatory in order to earn the right to live and work in our civilized culture. We have been under the impression that public schooling was about educating us as a measure to prepare us for life. But those assumptions were formed based upon information supplied to us by our natural predators, who may dress and speak like us, but in their minds, intentions, and actions, they hold us in contempt. They manage us like livestock, and they poison us both figuratively and literally, as if we were pests. Each of us has a choice to make, and the question is, what is most important to us? Is it the products which money buys, or is it having a safe, happy, and healthy family? Unfortunately, it doesn't seem that we can have both in this culture. We must choose to either put our full support behind that which is most important to us, or face losing everything. I made that choice 8 years ago, and through the help of some friends, I transformed the materials around me into the resources which have delivered this message to you. In the minutes before Patrick Henry spoke into existence the phrase, "Give me liberty or give me death," in his speech to the Second Virginia Convention on March 23, 1775, he first addressed the convention's president, Peyton Randolph of Williamsburg. Quote, "For my own part, I consider it as nothing less than a question of freedom or slavery, and in proportion to the magnitude of the subject ought to be the freedom of debate. It is only in this way that we can hope to arrive at truth and to fulfill the great responsibility which we hold to God and country. Should I keep back my opinions at such a time, through fear of giving offense, I should consider myself guilty of treason towards my country and an act of disloyalty toward the majesty of heaven, which I revere above all earthly kings. Mr. President, it is natural to man to indulge in the illusions of hope. We are apt to shut our eyes against painful truth and listen to the song of that siren until she transforms us into beasts. Is this the part of wise men engaged in a great and arduous struggle for liberty? Are we disposed to being of the number of those having eyes, see not, and having ears, hear not, the things which so nearly concern their temporal salvation? For my part, whatever anguish of spirit it may cost, I am willing to know the whole truth, to know the worst, and to provide for it." End quote. So, if you realize that your family and or community was in danger, how would you make them aware of it as a measure to protect them from the peril? Well, once you meet and surmount the mental obstacles by employing your use of reason, it would then be logical to organize the facts, connect and communicate with your loved ones and community, to learn together how to dispel confusion, how to take informed constructive actions, and when you meet resistance, how to learn your way forward. It doesn't benefit anyone to continue to sanitize the world for our youth, as it prevents them from developing a strong immune system and thereby undermines their chances of survival in this world. To that end, as I mentioned in the introduction, we've also created the ultimatehistorylesson.com, which specifically hosts the YouTube version of this interview in video form, as well as the MP3 versions for your downloading pleasure, as well as the transcript, references, notes, links, primary source materials, and every other piece of media associated with this interview set, all with the goal of helping you to understand. And while this all might sound like a good idea, most people need a little help outgrowing the habits which enable us to be so easily manipulated. In order to help each and every individual tap into their internal natural resources, we created TragedyandHope.com, which acts as a next step for those who seek to learn more after screening our productions. Now that you heard John talk about the book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time by Dr. Carol Quigley, you'll indeed appreciate the fact that we've created an international network of independent media producers, all of whom consistently provide educational films, podcasts, and video reports, commercial-free and free to the public. With over 1,400 people from all over the world posting videos, posting blogs, forming study and research groups, and learning the arts of intellectual self-defense and strategic problem solving, we've built a truly unique experience which has thus far been denied to the general public, and it is in every way designed to help you realize your birthright. In this last hour, I was surprised to learn about John's key role and helping Yoko Ono get approval to create Strawberry Fields, a section of Central Park in New York dedicated to John Lennon, across the street from where he was shot in front of the Dakota Hotel. We've done a lot since creating Tragedy and Hope in 2009, so let me share a bit of synchronicity about how all this began. These are the last few pages of the premiere issue of our interactive magazine before it evolved into an interactive community of critical thinkers. I'd say that not only have we come a long way, but we've also stayed on track, and I think that's reflected in the synchronicity of these full circle moments. We're serious about studying the big problems, identifying the root causes, and enacting constructive solutions. And we sure could use your help. And in return, we'll help you catch up on what you've been missing. We must ask the questions. Can we have peace without understanding the root causes of war? Can we have liberty without the responsibility and reason incorporated into our actions to bring it about? Why aren't we preparing our children for their lives? Why doesn't public schooling prepare us for the fact that we are entering a world where there are predators and systems of predation to be avoided? And in learning the answers, we found that it's due to the fact that the predators designed the public schooling system. It's time to reclaim our birthright, and this interview is aimed at delivering it to you. What you do with it is your choice. Figure out how to teach yourself anything by asking substantial questions and identifying valid answers. Help us create a network of affiliates and continue to spread this message of self-liberation. By understanding the problems, the solutions become known. The truth is the future, and we want to see what the world looks like when you develop the habits which reveal your inner potential. Last but not least, learn how to use the active literacies to liberate yourself and share what you've learned with others. Because the world is made up of words, and if you know the right words, you can make of the world what you will. Go and do likewise. Be persistent. Refuse to give your consent to irrationality, and realize that in your heart and mind, that we are only victims until we mature and take responsibility for our thoughts and actions. And to that end, keep learning. Keep moving forward. Thank you for tuning in and not dropping out.